Good morning. My name is John Weingart. I live in Surgeonsville in Hunterdon County, and I call the order the 71st meeting of the New Jersey Highlands Water Protection and Planning Council. The other members present, do you wish to address?
I'm Tim Dillingham. I'm a public member.
I'm Mimi Letts from Parsippany in Morris County.
Elizabeth Calabrese, Bergen County Freeholder.
Tracy Carluccio, public member, Hunterdon County.
And on the phone we have...
Debbie Pascarelli, Greenwich Township, Warren County.
And Scott Whitenack, public member, Morristown.
And walking down the hall is Tahisha Way. Somewhere in the building is Bill Cogger, and also walking down the hall. And there are several other members who are going to be joining us either in person or by phone, and making cameo or full appearances during the course of the day. Welcome. This meeting was advertised in accordance with the Open Public Meetings Act. All who wish, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
The Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Welcome to Bill Cogger, and thank you all for coming. I think Tahisha gets came from Atlantic City, so it's a particular badge of honor. We have in our packets minutes from our last meeting last week. A motion on the minutes.
Mr. Chairman, I move to approve the minutes.
A second?
Second.
Any comments or corrections?
Mr. Chair, I received an email from Debbie, and she asked me to go back in and listen to the recording and change her comments. They are on page 11 of the minutes, and it's in reference to the conversation on the wastewater management plans. And where her comments say, she also stated that she believes that there isn't sufficient support to make these standards a choice of the municipality. We have struck that and instead offer for your consideration. She stated that the question is, does the plan conform to the regional master plan? Yes or no? We are not requiring anything, just does it or not. Conformance is voluntary. Changing the standard doesn't change that. Debbie is on the phone. I had sent this suggested correction language to Debbie.
Eileen, I couldn't hear you, but just the last part. But yes, thank you, Eileen, for doing that. And I reviewed the changes this morning. And thank you. I think it's clarified now. And I will vote in favor of the minutes.
Any other clarifications or corrections? Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? The minutes carry. For Bill and Tisha, I don't know if you heard, obviously Debbie's on the phone, and Scott Whitenack is also on the phone. Others may be joining us. I believe Janice and Eric are going to join us in one form or another. I wanted to mention one item. At last week's meeting, I outlined a schedule for getting... considering the adoption of the regional master plan and possible amendments to it. And last week I talked about the possibility of considering the amendments on a separate date on June 26th and then considering the amended resolution in effect to adopt the plan on July 17th. And I sent an email, but after talking to council members, but after talking to some of you and thinking about it further, I think it would work better if we do it more the way we did it with adopting the final draft plan last November, where one July 17th, we have a resolution to adopt the proposed the final plan, and then members who want to make amendments to that make the amendments on that date. We consider the amendments, vote each amendment up or down, and then have public comment on an amended resolution about the plan, and then vote on the amended resolution whether to approve the plan with those changes or not. What I So I think it would be better to do it that way, but I do think it would also be good if members, particularly, got a chance to review as much as possible amendments that members, other individual members, know they want to make in advance of that. So what I would ask is that if you are planning to make amendments to the plan, if there are changes you would like to see and would like to make amendments to do that, that you put them in writing and get them to council members in advance of the July 10th meeting. And then at the meeting on July 10th, we would have a part of the agenda where members who had amendments could explain the reason, what they're trying to accomplish with the amendment and introduce it. Not introduce it in the sense of formally introducing it, but explain it to members. And that would give us a chance, other members a chance to ask questions about it, make clarifications. If it turns out in the course of that discussion that there are wording changes that members want to make to their proposed amendments or members who want to collaborate on proposed amendments, we'd have an extra week for those discussions to take place. And then on July 17th, the amendments could be formally introduced. And obviously, if ideas popped up that you hadn't discussed on July 10th and you wanted to make an amendment on July 17th, you could do that. So one thing, I hope that's clear, but for another, I hope that makes sense to people and that would be an okay way to proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good idea because I was concerned about the June 26th date. I don't think we will have fleshed out and finalized all the issues that we may or may not be putting amendments on in on. So I think it's a good idea to do it up a week ahead and have everything in writing and, you know, an opportunity for the council to discuss it and then kind of have this space between the 10th and the 17th for, you know, more thought to go into what is actually going to be presented on the 17th as a finalized amendment. Like you said, last minute something could be done, but at least that way, having, you know, the written ones and the discussion on the 10th, it allows us to talk it out as a council. And as you said, make changes or put them in different forms. But I think we're certainly not ready for that by the next meeting. I think we just have too many open issues that we need to flesh out and discuss further before we finalize amendments.
Mr. Chair, you said that you asked members to share with council
yes.
members. Would it be possible to share?
Yeah. With you. Yeah, I was going to say that you should send it. When you put the amendments in writing, you can send them at a minimum to me and Eileen, and if you want to send them to the rest of the council. Either we'll make sure the rest of the council gets them, or you can do that.
In that way, we could be prepared for the ramifications of change. If there's a domino effect and they have to change elsewhere, that we would be prepared to advise council.
Mr. Chairman, have we had any requests from the public to make amendments, specific amendments?
We've had about 2 hours of them at every meeting, hasn't
it? No. I find the specific amendments.
Other than that.
Right. No, it would just be good to have as much input prior to that as possible so that we can duly review everything before we pass it. I want to make sure that the members and the public have a due opportunity for it.
Well, the major opportunity was the comments on the November draft, so we have all those comments. We're all receiving email from at least the Highlands Coalition with their comments on an hourly, weekly basis, I guess. But certainly other members of the public who have comments they want to submit can do that. That's the way we'll proceed then, if that's okay. The only other item I want to mention is just that one member of this extended family who's been at many meetings will be leaving shortly, and that's Jan Berry from the Bergen Record, who is retiring at the end of the month. I just learned he's here today, so I just wanted to thank him for his work covering the environment in Bergen County and New Jersey for many years, and he's going to become a professor teaching about journalism and the environment. So. Did someone just join us on the phone?
It's Janice Kovach.
Welcome. Any council members have other items they wish to report at this point? Okay, go to the executive director's report.
Hey, good morning all. It's been a short week since we last saw you. So very briefly, just to let you know that we did speak at the last meeting about doing a very tentative agenda to take us through to July 17th. I did send it out to you twice because
seeing as it's so tentative, it changed from the time I first changed, sent it to the next day. It is also posted, though, for the public, because I did commit to that as well. So if you go to our website and you go to the calendar, up on top of the calendar, it's written, and I hope it's bold that we try, to say that there's a tentative agenda there to take us from there for June 26th, July 10th, and July 17th for the items. And as I say, it is subject to change, so please accept it. There will be additions to it and refinements to it, and we'll try to keep changing it, posting it in that manner as well. The other thing we committed to at the meeting last week was to post the build-out information, the report, and the appendices on the web today. We are still intending to do that by close of business today. And if close of business is our business, so if that's 7 o'clock and the staff are here, then that's when it will be posted. But we will try to do it today. So the only concerns I sometimes have are that it is a huge document. If we run into any problems, we'll get as much of it up as we can in terms of the report and the appendices. We also did some quality control to look through and sort of do some, using GIS to sort of go down and see if we could find any issues that we wanted to address. And we're going to issue a short report on that as well, so that when people find something, they say, well, why is this included? In as much as we can, we'll explain why certain things are included and how they affect the build-out. So that'll all be up today. I'll send an email to all of you when we get that up. And that's it until session on Monday.
Questions? There are no committee reports and no local grants or to consider, so back to the regional master plan discussion.
Okay.
John, I have a question.
Yes?
About the agenda document that Eileen just reviewed for us. I just have a clarification question for two items that are listed under June 26th. The last two that are listed as outstanding issues. Can you just refresh my memory and review where we stand with both of those?
What do you mean? With what are the outstanding issues?
WQMP review policies and prime groundwater recharge areas. We've talked about so many of these things. It's just fuzzy for me. Where, you know, we taking straw polls or, you know, what's still outstanding? What are we doing? So I'm prepared for the June 26th meeting.
Okay, I understand. On the WQMP review policies, the council at the last meeting asked us to come back to make it very clear what the DEP new rules state and what are the applicable standards in the regional master plan. We will do that in a table format and give it back to you with a response to the other issues that you have brought up. So when we say it's an outstanding issue, you're looking for more information from us in order to resolve the issue that you debated at the last meeting.
Okay.
That's WQMP.
And what we voted in the straw vote was that we were not happy, comfortable with the staff recommendation.
That we were not looking to change what basically had been in place. Would you say that's how to describe it, John?
I would say we were not. We voted to not accept the staff recommendation.
Okay.
So it leaves it open as to what we are accepting. To be determined. Okay. I mean, so that's... So it is an outstanding issue of what policy we want in there and how it would be expressed.
And the second issue was prime groundwater recharge, and council asked for a white paper from the staff to explain the staff's recommendation so that the council would make a decision on that issue as well. So what happened was we had white paper was actually ready, but as I hadn't sent it out with the packet, we wanted to make sure that you had enough time to read that information, given that this packet was rather large. So for those who can't see, I just got a lot of looks. So that's why we decided that we should, in terms of looking at the agenda, the size of the agenda, I talked with the chair, and he advised that we send that out after this meeting. So that matter is still outstanding. There may be some other issues and refinements, but some of them, those rose to the level of being necessary to call out on their own. There are other, as you know, other issues pertaining to other documents. So, in terms of today, we've given you highlighted versions so that you can see where we've made changes to language after council meetings.
Thank you.
let me just clarify one thing that we said. The next meeting is in 2 weeks, June 26th, and that one is at 4 o'clock. And then the 2 weeks after that, July 10th and July 17th, are at 10 o'clock.
Okay, we're going to start going through the PowerPoint and to help us through today's discussion. And I found myself that at times it's difficult to figure out which document. So I will make sure to read out which document that we're discussing so that you can follow. The first matter on the agenda under Regional Master Plan discussion is Forest Resource Management Program. The title of the document you're looking at is Forest Resource Management and Sustainability. This program was updated to support the goals, policies, and objectives that we have discussed at previous meetings. Indeed, you'll find as we go through this, mostly most of the changes are to be consistent with the GPOs. You drop the GPOs into the program, the relevant ones, and then you make sure that the program language is consistent with those GPOs. We added text regarding the fact that a partial cost share reimbursement is available for non-profit organizations through the New Jersey Forest Services Forest Stewardship Program. And we removed the third-party certification for Highlands Forest Products element of the program. Staff concluded that this goal is not realistic at this time. And more important is for the staff to focus the program on sustainable guidance, which is the first step toward that certification scheme. We wanted to be realistic about what can be achieved, so we removed that and are going to focus on other elements, including that the sustainable guidance. Those are the major changes to that particular program.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman, in this program. It's on objective 1C2D. I was going to say what page number, but we don't have page numbers. I was surprised to see that we crossed out that could be used to issue farmland tax assessment, farmland assessment tax credits. Remember, we had talked about supporting incentives and other ways of demonstrating how a landowner is fulfilling stewardship goals, and we had agreed in the past that what we were trying to do was allow a credit or in lieu of cash, we would try to get the law changed that we would allow that a credit for in lieu of cash those programs could be substituted. As it is now, as we know, woodland management plans require the production of cash, usually by cutting down trees, under a woodland management plan. And the Forest Stewardship Program, of course, is in place, but it doesn't allow you to substitute the income that you would get from selling trees with a Forest Stewardship Program. So I know Kurt had brought this up last meeting, but I think he was talking about it in terms of agriculture, not in terms of forest. So am I reading this wrong, or what was the reason we were taking this out?
Ron Farr and Aaron Lyman both worked on this. They're not here, so I'll turn it to Dan if you want. But I will say that we did think that the language we added to the beginning of that was broad enough to encompass it, to support incentives and funding opportunities. And then it reads on and provide criteria for demonstrating and maintaining intrinsic forest values and societal benefits. But is there any other clarification, Dan?
The other issue is we received very strong comments from a number of interests that if this mechanism is put in place, that it should be put in place separate from the farmland assessment program. There's a very strong feeling that the farmland assessment program was not the right avenue for putting something like this in place. And so the concern was if you open up that law, then you have the potential for it being diluted in effectiveness or reoriented. So there was support for the concept, which we left in 1CD 2D, and also put in policy 1B8, which says to encourage the development of forest management strategies and programs that improve the ecological, water resources, benefits, and scenic quality of Highlands Forest. And then in terms of exactly how to do that, that was left for additional research. So the concept was supported, but the mechanism of the Pharma Assessment Act raised a lot of concerns, and that's the reason.
Could you remind me where in the public comments or who made these comments about removing any reference to the Pharma Assessment Program?
I know the Farm Bureau made comments along that line. We have received comments from the forestry interests as well with regard to that. Again, there's support for the concept, but not for the amendment of that act. And I think it ties in part with other issues that are swirling around the Farm Land Assessment Act itself. So I think there's a reluctance to touch that act.
I read this change as broadening the policy to say that we would consider any means of implementing that goal, which could include farmland assessment, but could include other.
That's what we tried to capture in the opening part of that.
I think the opening part of the sentence definitely does that. I agree, and I think that's a good change. But I think mentioning the farmland assessment program is very specific and adds more of a specific goal to that objective. And I would argue that by mentioning the Farmland Assessment Act, we're not opening the door to dilution of that act. We're simply talking about an amendment. And actually there is, you know, every single legislative session, I believe, there has been a bill introduced, and it never goes anywhere, to allow this type of change, to allow the Forest Stewardship Program credits to be used in lieu of cash for a woodland management plan under the Farmland Assessment Program. And I think, you know, it's a reasonable change, and it's considering the importance of our forest resources, it makes a lot of sense that we would try to use any tool, including the specific tool of the Farmland Assessment Program. I think, you know, one of the problems we have here is that the woodland management programs are sort of almost a stepchild and have become more important over the years than the original farmland assessment program was. You know, it was mainly thinking about acres of agricultural, you know, actively farmed land. And it's become more and more used for woodland programs. But, I mean, I remember discussing this as a council in the past, and I think we all are aware that a lot of people cut down a lot of trees under a woodland management program because they have to in order to get their farmland assessment. And that does not help us. And if we do something in the highlands, in the forest resource area, which is what we're talking about here, the forest resource area, then we will be, to allow, in lieu of cash, a stewardship program that enhances the intrinsic forest values, we'll be handing a gift to a lot of people who don't want to be cutting these trees down. I would just also like to point out that the Farmland Assessment Act, yes, I agree, there's a lot of issues swirling around that, but they have really stepped up the pressure through inspections. And if you haven't cut down your trees, they're removing people's farmland assessments, so people are scared. And sometimes they're going overboard. And I'm not going to get into the details, but I think the way that the state is going into the details through these inspectors is very damaging. And I've seen a lot more trees cut down than should be cut down in order just for people, you know, going to extra measure because they're afraid they're going to all of a sudden have to pay full tax value on, you know, hundreds of acres of woodland. So I would like to argue that we keep that language in, and would like to know what other council members feel about that.
Let me see if other council members have feeling for this one way or the other.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to hear. I know that that's not the way we usually conduct these hearings, right, but I would like to hear from the people who wanted to change, the public, the Farm Bureau or whoever, to hear their reasoning for wanting it taken out.
What I want to do is to alert you that this is going to come up again in the same meeting, because in the agricultural resource program, we hit on the same issue. And if you recall, Farm Bureau spoke at this meeting and asked us to remove the language that referred to, it was policy 3B4, and it will be coming up again, but we removed the language advocate for the amendment of the Farmland Assessment Act to permit the inclusion of credits, and we spoke about invasive plant control and white-tailed deer, etc. And at that public meeting, we heard representatives from the Farm Bureau ask us, and our Department of Ag, ask us not to include that language because they were concerned with opening up of that Act. So consistent with that request for Ag, we've changed it in both Ag and Forestry, trying to leave the opportunities open, because I certainly agree with what you're saying, Tracy, but not, but be adhering to their concern that if you open up that Act, that they may lose the provisions they've fought so hard to gain already. That's the concern, so you're going to have to deal with this twice.
It seems to me that, I mean, what we're talking about here is the language that would be in the plan about what position the council would take on supporting a piece of legislation that might or may not be introduced in the future. The way the staff's amended language leaves it open that we could support changes in farmland assessment tax credits, or that we would consider that at the time and use this policy to say that was an effective way to meet this goal or not, and that to be more specific at this point is not necessary in terms of implementing the plan, and probably would merit having a full discussion so that we didn't just hear from the Farm Bureau and the Part of Ag, but heard other interests on this issue as well. So I'd be in favor of keeping language the way this has changed.
I agree with you, John.
Are there other members interested in changing it at this point?
I just think there's value in keeping it specific. I mean, as Tracy said, that you know, the legislature periodically does re-examine the final act. And I'm sorry, Ivy, I missed your comments, but you have taken positions in here on very specific aspects. It's a little ironic that in light of all the criticism we get about the regulatory approaches that we are championing in this plan, that when we go to look for market mechanisms and building on established programs, that we get pushback on that. It's a tool that's there, it's a tool that's well established, it's a tool I think that very credibly can be extended to the ecological benefits as well as the taking a commodity product off the land, products off the land. So I don't think it does any harm. As you say, you have to get into the debate in another forum anyways. The idea that this very specifically would help advance the council's plan has some value to it.
Mr. Chairman, I think a major aspect of the Act and always the addition to protecting our water is to protect farmland. And if the farmers feel that this should not be in that, I'm inclined to agree with them. You know, I would trust that they know more about some of these things. I agree with what Tracy is saying, that you know that we do run the risk possibly of forest being cut down, but I would hope that we could deal with these in other ways than what the Farm Bureau disagrees with.
Well, I don't hear a groundswell of opinion to change the staff recommendation, so unless there are others who would like to do that, we can both move on. Further?
Second item before you today is restoration of streams and riparian areas program changes. The document you're looking at is called Restoration of Streams and Riparian Areas. Again, consistent with the GPOs, what we've included now in this program is the functional value assessment concept. It was added to stream and riparian assessment element of the program. It provides a measurable and scientific approach to ensure improvements to stream buffer functional values. Stream corridor protection restoration plans element was added to the program. The goal of these plans is to identify areas where existing land uses within buffers have impaired the functional values of those buffers and to identify opportunities for restoration of those areas. Highlands, Open Waters and Riparian Areas, GPOs. This shows the final version of GPOs previously considered by the Highlands Council on May 22, 2008. And what I did to facilitate, what staff did to facilitate the Council's review is to highlight the sections indicating proposed changes based on the Council's discussion at that meeting. Those were objective 1D4I. Those, and then there's five parts of that. Those are highlighted because we did make changes there in response to the council discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I was not present at the meeting in which this was discussed, but I have to say I have very serious concerns about this new idea of allowing municipalities and counties to craft a plan that would allow them to waive or minimize the buffers around Highlands Open Waters and riparian areas. And for a number of reasons. One is I don't think they have the capacity to do that. I don't think there is a methodology that is established that we would use to evaluate such plans, make sure that they're comparable to the level of protection. When we went through this the first time, we debated endlessly the science behind the establishment of those buffer widths. And we tied them back to watershed integrity, a whole series of values. We're developing a regional plan here, which towns, counties are supposed to conform to. It's not, let's go out and rewrite the standards that we've gone through, develop science, which they do not have the capacity to do, either on a local basis or a regional basis. So I think just as an implementation question, it becomes tremendously difficult to do this. And I think the bottom line is it just creates a loophole and problems to minimize and do away with the protective buffers that we've decided through the work we've done is more appropriate around the screen floor. So I would ask that we delete number four out of this completely.
Mr. Chairman, I agree that we should remove this plan. So I think it would be policy, or it would be objective 1D4I. At any rate, I see that there were some changes made based on the discussion a couple meetings ago, that there was an attempt to try to improve this section. However, bottom line is that what this means is that buffers can be reduced to 50 feet. It just has to, or whatever the state law is, 75 feet, 50 feet, whatever it shakes out to be at a point in time in terms of other state regulations is going to be the minimum buffer. Now, I understand about the functional value analysis, but I think, we can just look at how that has been applied through the DEP stormwater regulations to see that it is a highly imperfect process. And I think that as a result of the functional value analysis that was required under the stormwater rules in order to reduce the buffers, we've ended up intruding on waters that shouldn't have been intruded on. And I've seen examples of that by specific developments. This allows a whole town, for a plan to be put together for an entire area, which would reduce those buffers as long as they, meet some amorphous goal of a functional value analysis. And I'm not trying to be flip by saying amorphous. I think that there was effort put into trying to, flesh out what a functional value analysis is. And I think that towns are not used to doing this. We're not used to doing this. It layers on to this program complexity that's unnecessary. Bottom lines, we want to reduce, change land use and impervious cover next to our waterways. And we're opening the door to do away with meeting that goal through these stream plans. I like the restoration idea. I don't like the idea of the stream corridor protection plan being left open to be reduced all the way down to 50 feet. And I think that's what we do. So I also believe that we should remove this objective ID4I completely.
Who makes the determination of approval on the plan?
The Highlands Council does, because it's a plan conformance.
It's the same Highlands Council whose science last week we argued about septic density. It's the same people involved. I mean, we're going to use the same clarity that we did. I have difficulty in accepting septic densities 1 week based on science and saying that we don't have the ability to do it here. I think you've got to buy in one way or the other.
I hear what you're saying. And Bill, I totally agree that we have great staff, we have great science, we've done a tremendous
job in gathering data. But I think as a council, we have to take the long view, and we have to have very specific lines in place going forward, because whereas we may have confidence now in what we're doing, I don't know that 3 years from now, 5 years from now, we will have in place the same confidence that you have, right now. So the science is not changing. The science for the nitrate dilution, the science that supports the 300-foot buffer is there. What we're saying is we're going to deviate from that science based on policy.
We're talking C2 water, Category 2?
Yes.
Water?
Absolutely.
Category 1, right?
Pardon?
We're talking open water?
Yes. Yes, that's what we discussed for 2 years, to apply it to all of Highlands open waters.
And ID4I only, and Dan, please correct me if I'm wrong, is only for previously disturbed areas.
That's correct. Yes. That's the key point, is that you start with, you stay out of the non-disturbed areas. So that's the first step. And then the question is, what sort of plan can be used to result in a net benefit to the stream, recognizing that some of the disturbed areas may stay disturbed, some of them may have increased disturbance within the...
Could you speak up, Dan? I can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Basically, Debbie, it was just to the point to clarify that this is only for where there is previous existing development disturbances or land use within the Highlands Open Waters that have reduced or impaired the functional value. All those the ability then to different buffers is only in those cases. So it's not in undisturbed areas. I just wanted to clarify that, make sure that council members realize that.
Mr. Chairman, we were discussing this previously. It was said that, for example, what this would deal with is where you have a topography where the land slopes down and away from the body of water, that it really would not have any negative impact on the water. And I agree with that, and I think that that then gives us more latitude to better plan in these areas that have already been disturbed. I think we have to allow some flexibility if we're going to ever be able to do any kind of real restoration. That's something that you and I have talked about a great deal, is the need to restore these streams. I know in my town there's streams that need to be restored, but I think that we've got to allow a little flexibility. And I would hope that we would have enough talent in our staff and the municipalities to make reasonable recommendations that both give better protection to the stream but also allow repairing of these developed areas. I think we should leave the flexibility. I mean, maybe there are some where it says topography, vegetation, cover type, and maybe there's some of these pieces you may want to take out. You might want to say just due to topography or whatever. I don't know what would be appropriate.
I have a question and a comment.
Yes, Debbie.
My question is, when we refer to previously disturbed, we're including areas disturbed by agriculture but for which there's no what we would call construction on it?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Well, I might have a comment about that later. I'm still trying to figure some of this out myself. But I'd like to comment or address Bill on the point he brought up about science. I am not a scientist in this area, and I certainly struggle along with probably other council members in trying to render proper policy decisions when we're not scientists and we're dealing with a lot of heavy science. But I do see, and I understand Bill's point, and I've thought about that many times myself when assessing these issues, but I think Bill, you said something like, why science here but not there? I think it's because there are differences in the issues we discuss. Not all methodologies are created equal. Not all methodologies are as well established. Some of them are debatable. That's certainly where I've come down on some of these issues and why I have a concern, for example, with recharge, some of the recharge issues. We're talking about sort of theoretical things that maybe will result or the scientists can predict reasonably may result, but there's not a certainty there. And in this case, I think with the septic we were discussing last time, those issues are well established, what constitutes deterioration or hazards or whatever terms we want to use, certainly debate on what's the proper level, but the issue of it is established. Here, I don't think it's so black and white. So we certainly could debate that, but just to address that point, you know, to your specific question, these are not all similar issues. They're not just in terms of their content, but also their establishment and their controversy and whatever.
There are other comments on this issue?
Just a question, Mr. Chair. So let me understand this. The municipality would formulate a plan and then come back to this council for approval?
We would work with the municipality. We would have our technical staff work with them, and we would give grants as well and assist them. And, you know, so we would work with them.
So this would be within the context of plan conformance?
Yes, it is an element of plan conformance. And with all those elements, we provide guidance, have technical assistance, and provide grant money so that they could hire consultants who are qualified to do this type of work. But they would do it with us, and it finally come back for your approval to the plan conformance process.
Just a couple of things on the conversation. It's not clear to me that the language in this is limited to disturbed areas. Okay, and so it talks about identifying areas, but it doesn't say, you know, this shall only be implemented or applied only to areas that are less than the 300-foot buffer. So there's a lack of clarity there. And when I read it, it seemed to me that Section 4 said you do this on a town-wide basis, and you can equally apply areas in which we would do restoration or minimization of the buffer. So that's indeed the objective, that this is a restoration plan as opposed to a modification of the buffer zones. That's one thing I think that would be
point taken.
So, and then secondly, and I'm all for restoration, and I think that the idea, the difference in the methodology, the scientific aspects of this, is that, as I said, we spent a lot of time developing the science, developing the methodology, contracting with USGS to come up with the septic system densities and the other, the nitrate evaluations and the other programs we did. We have not done that in the way that this talks about doing a plan across a large geography that's going to go back and forth. So there's not a template there. So I think it is a little bit apples and oranges on that part of it. So I think that if this is about restoring buffers to the standard that we've set, then that's a different goal than the way I read 4, which opened that door, as I said, to minimizing the process.
I think around the first part of what you're saying, at least, the way to do it would be basically to repeat number 1 in number 4. So that it would say something like, you know, so number 1 says identify areas where existing development disturbances or land uses are within the open private open water buffers, never used or impaired the functional value of those buffers. But number 4 means to say, I think, within those areas, identify locations where, based on scientific analysis.
Right.
Right.
We can do
yeah.
that, absolutely.
But then
that doesn't remove all your concerns.
I understand then that, you know, where it talks about identifying locations where the full 300-foot buffer is not necessary. That just doesn't seem to fit into the idea of if you're applying this only to places where you're already having less than that standard in place. Okay, that reads to me like identified places where some argument is going to be made that the buffer is not going to be necessary. And I can't help but have in the back of my mind the debate that's going on about there, led by many municipal leaders in the Highlands region about the C1 program, about the non-necessity of this, about, you know, minimizing it in other places. So that's, I don't think language meets the purposes that you're describing to me as the goal in doing this.
I would just like to add that I think, you know, Debbie's point is important, that everyone understands what previously disturbed means. And, you know, in a town where there's the borough and then the surrounding areas, I mean, where is this going to become important? It's going to become important where development, where we are under the plan saying development should go, which is going to be agricultural areas, and it's going to be already developed areas. So I think that, you know, realistically, when this plays out, we're going to see that we're not going to achieve 300-foot buffers. in a town that has agriculture and that is already developed. And I think our goal was, in order to restore streams where they're already impaired and to protect our high integrity and medium integrity, because as Tim said, we in the earlier draft, hooked it back into watershed integrity. So what we were trying to do is say, well, you've got those high quality waterways, we want to keep a 300-foot buffer. And then what the earlier draft said, which, you know, I did not support, but what it did say was, then you could reduce it down to 150 or 775 feet, depending on the watershed integrity. It was an imperfect solution, but I would argue that this is more imperfect because it doesn't even have that tie-in to the integrity of the waterway. So we're sort of throwing out the evaluation of the value of that resource and just looking at it where it's going to be convenient to develop because it's already been developed or it's agricultural. And I don't think that's the way to go about this.
You know, let me just say, since I'm familiar with streams that have been seriously impeded in the past, an example, let's say that you have a developer and he wants to do something in the area and he is willing to restore the stream, which has been totally eroded by now and has no embankment left. And he's willing to take up macadam, which is up to within 5 feet of that riverbank now. He's willing to do all of this if he can do something else that might be within 300 feet of this thing. I mean, isn't it worth it to at least allow the flexibility that we could consider that? I mean, that kind of an investment is very, very expensive to do stream restoration.
I would just like to say, I think that that is a site-by-site, project-by-project analysis. This allows, during the conformance process, for a town to guess about those areas from the get-go. So we're sort of like laying down already the goal of a 300-foot buffer.
But if they want to, as part of their plan, start to put into their plans, you know, the kinds of incentives for developers to do these things, then we have to allow the flexibility. You know, or they'll be back at us all the time. I think we have to allow that flexibility if we want to achieve what we really want to achieve. You know, if we make everything a hard and fast rule, there will be no purpose for us anyway.
Can I just clarify as well that they can't just guess because the disturbed area must have reduced or impaired the functional values of the buffer. So that functional value study has to be done. And then remembering that it comes back to the council. And if you feel that the work isn't good enough and that if it is too broad-based and it doesn't meet the goals of the RMP, and remember we are talking about C2 waters here, we felt we examined what was done previously in the November release 2007 and felt that this was stricter than and more protective than those.
I think they're that the 75 foot and the 150 was, I argued against that, offered an amendment on it. So I do agree that that draft did not have an acceptable solution for how to provide flexibility, that the flexibility that Amy's talking about. But I think this doesn't do it either. And I think what we're doing here, you know, it could be argued, is actually going to be worse because the functional value analysis is not a reliable substitution for all of the science that went into establishing the 300-foot buffer. I mean, I think, you know, when Bill talked about the science backs up a 300-foot buffer. That's where we arrived at. As a matter of fact, it says in many instances you need 1,000 feet. And we put that in here, that it can be expanded if need be. But I think what we're going to get here is we're not going to get any restoration. We're just going to get continued development and maybe a little bit of averaging of the buffer here. Not averaging, that's the wrong word to specifically say. It can happen. But a little bit of tweaking, perhaps, but this is heavily weighted towards continuing to develop the areas that are developed, not restore those areas, and to reduce the buffer probably to 50 feet, if they can argue, you know, or the value analysis allows it, for agricultural areas, and those are the areas where we're pushing the development.
Okay, what if we...
Bill, wait, no, Bill.
This will be done during planning conformance.
Yes.
So the council will vote either to accept the plan or reject the plan?
Yes.
So if the plan were 80% good, or 90% good, and were 10% bad in this area, to use an example, where they, quote, guessed on an area, then we really would either have to reject the entire plan, not that aspect, right?
No, you can go back in and work with them and say, we don't approve it for the following reasons, and then the staff would go back.
Right, yes, we would be rejecting the plan.
You would be
rejecting the plan. Right. So
yes,
what happens is then you're in an argument in terms of whether the plan offers you enough or too little. And I see some problems with that. I get very worried when we use science, you know, because I'm not so sure science has gotten us as far as we'd like to go as people sometimes. We rely on it. But I am also concerned that we broker deals with the devil, so to speak, to get to a certain point. So I think you may be right. We need more flexibility. I agree with Mimi. We ought to be able to go in and do some great stuff and work with developers to do restoration. But on the other hand, I don't want to be here and hold a plan hostage for an element. And I could see how that could create, you know, some problems.
I want to agree with Bill on that point, that I think that predictability, as much as we can put it into this plan, ought to be a part of it. I've said that the idea of kicking unanswered questions down to the counties and municipalities to be answered during conformance and then to come back to the council is not the right way to do that, particularly when we've invested very heavily in trying to establish some rational standard that's fairly easily expressed. On Mimi's point, I agree with you, Mimi, that in areas, particularly in the redevelopment areas, we want some flexibility, and we want there are other ways, other techniques, other best management practices which can give the same kind of water quality protections that are most appropriately used there. But this, I think, is a case of good intentions, and you know, the path to hell is paved with good intentions. This language doesn't say that to me. This doesn't say only in redevelopment areas we're gonna look to trade buffer widths for other management approaches that might do that. I don't disagree with the idea that there are circumstances, particularly in disturbed areas, and that we may want to look at a variety of tools in addition to buffers, but I don't think this section does that.
If we could focus more in on site-specific opportunities within the...
Well, I guess the question is, if the language in 4 was changed somehow to say, I think it's hard to change, but either the way I read it is probably not exactly right, but to make it clear that 4 applies to areas of existing development or disturbed areas, what I'm hearing is that at least Tracy and Tim would still opt for that not being there, that section. Are there other members who would opt for it not being there?
Let me ask something. If we said, okay, you can get relief from the 300-foot buffer if you meet these criteria, but you could not go below 100 feet? I mean, is there some other criteria that would possibly be acceptable? I understand that this would only go down to 75, right? That would be the...
It cannot go any lower than state regulations would allow for.
Which would be
50 or 75?
Yeah, under flood hazard area rules, it's 50, but it would depend on the case. Jason was talking about this earlier. Under other scenarios, it might be 75 feet, but it depends on the state requirement.
So is there a threshold that would be acceptable? I really am concerned. I often agree with you, but I disagree with you that if we make this too strict, then I think that we're going to have a difficult time getting restoration done. But I'm very concerned about it.
Could I ask the people in public to not whisper, because I carry the episodes before, the sound carries peculiarly in this room, and we hear every word you say.
I think, you know, if we want to talk about a minimum, it would help. But I think it should not be townwide plans. I think it should be on site-specific basis. I think it's safer that way. It doesn't open a door for, you know, for dilution of our goal of protecting the waterway. And it would be really tailored to us, to the level of detail that we need in order to make the decision about the functional value analysis. I just can't see a town going in and doing this functional value analysis, even with our staff's help, for a whole municipality. It's, I mean, think about how much time it takes to figure out that for one development project. I just can't see that it's going to be the level of detail that holds up when you compare it to the science that supports the Green River Buffer.
Well, as I read this policy, if the town couldn't do it, it wouldn't happen. If they couldn't make that analysis, the council wouldn't. They might not propose it, or the council wouldn't approve it. The town, in conformance, would not. Might well only be focusing on a small number of locations within the town that are developable, to meet the council's criteria for being developable, and/or areas they want to develop. So their analysis might be limited to one or a small number of locations in the course of conformance.
I guess we just don't know.
Yeah. I guess, let me.
Is it possible that we say, okay, towns don't have to put the entire town into a plan that addresses this? But could we substitute saying that towns can do, or we would help them develop ordinances that would allow them on site plan application to deviate from the 300-foot buffer, provided that they are doing restoration? Okay, so that kind of gets to your site specific, because in the end, we'll be looking at specific sites.
Right.
So if the town develops an ordinance that would address it, that would say, you know, these things, say that there is a 300-foot buffer unless, you know, they are developed areas.
Well, I think maybe you're adding an extra step. I mean, I think that is the intention of this policy, that the council and the town in discussions around conformance do what you're saying. And
but rather than have to come in with a plan that says in this area we're going to shrink the buffer, because it's what we will say is the town is going to allow the buffer to be shrunk on those applications that have these characteristics.
Well, that would be better, but I think I would just also like to point out, if we deal with it on site-specific basis and flexibility on a site-specific basis, and such as we talk about under 5, which is having to do with redevelopment areas, but we're talking, but I'd just like to point out the original the November 2007 draft has 75 feet as the floor. Now it's down to 50. So yes. I want to point that out. And perhaps it's at 75, depending on how you interpret the water quality management plan. And it also depends on certain values in the stream. It has to do with various species down in the stream, and you can get a bigger buffer from 50 depending on that. But as far as the flexibility, I think the flexibility can be provided on a case-by-case basis for a site-specific application. And that would be appropriate to be pulled out from this restoration portion. I would argue that the idea of having a restoration plan is great. Let's have it. Let's have it separate from shrinking the buffer, because it's just mixing up the opportunities here, and I think it ends up being a let's reduce the buffer plan rather than a let's restore the buffer plan. So I think we need to separate this concept and have two different sections. And then the section that deals with the flexibility that Mimi's trying to go for should be based on site-specific applications having to do with redevelopment areas. Also like to point out that this is not just the existing community zone. Remember, this is in the protection zone and the conservation zone. It's all zones that this can be reduced.
Let me ask if anyone on the phone has comments on this section.
Nothing further for me.
I'm okay, John.
Okay.
I just one comment. I could see where an area-wide plan, though, would have effect if you have a long stream corridor that is disturbed, and you have a development application that is in the center, let's say, for example, and it may not be palatable to approve that on a site-specific basis without restoration efforts taking place in a broader area. And so you could argue the that you'd want to plan for restoration of the entire corridor, as opposed to just, you know, well, I want to do this and it's okay, and I'm going to remove some asphalt in this 50-foot section or 100-foot section, but, you know, that the junkyard up the street that is, you know, got the cars pushed into the stream, we're not going to touch. You know, I could see some merit to arguing, well, we want an entire plan that says that this needs to be restored before we're willing to waive the buffer all along. So don't just look at it as site-specific being the best effort. You may want to be a little bit broader. And I don't know, that may be part of what the intent was, I think, in looking at it.
That's not a bad idea to say, particularly in the redevelopment zone,
exactly.
Right, where we're making a judgment that there's redevelopment, to then use that to more broadly do restoration. It may not be particularly on that site, but maybe in a geography which influences that site and that same stream corridor. I don't think that's a bad idea. Again, I don't think this says that, but it goes into Tracy's suggestion that perhaps we limit this discussion and reframe it around redevelopment and restoration, as opposed to a town-wide plan that identifies places where the buffers are minimized. Then we're talking about two different animals.
Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe this is an area that lends itself to a proposed amendment to consider changing wording, but I don't hear a consensus for changing this or for considering changing it, unless I'm wrong. I mean, unless other people haven't spoken. So I think there is a consensus for making it clear this what areas this refers to, and that beyond that.
Clear, you mean redevelopment?
Yeah. Well, right. Or, yeah, developed. Disturbed, or again, areas where existing development or disturbances are, I guess, basically the, what this was meant to apply to.
Or right? Have reduced or impaired the functional values.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's limited
only
to that.
Only applies to that.
Right. And then and with that clarification, there are still concerns from at least several members, but not a majority. And so let's leave it at that for the moment. And again, if it lends itself to considering amendments, we'll do that.
Okay.
So we move on to the third of the 16 items we're considering.
The next item is Highlands Restoration Water Deficits, and that's the name of the document you're looking at. That same document has the efficient use of water in it, so that the two of those are together. The Water Deficit Reduction Program. The program summary includes additional text on what types of water uses are part of a net water availability analysis. We modified Objective 2B, 8B, and relevant program language to reflect council discussions on white papers regarding water use and conservation management plans being required for all sub-watersheds and especially for deficit areas. The range of mitigation requirements, this is pursuant to the council meeting we had on GPOs relative to this, the range is now from 125% to 200%, dependent on the level of deficit and the amount of water being sought, or the demand. The contents of mitigation plans, the timing of mitigation being relative to the volume of increased consumptive depleted water uses, and the existing deficit, which is that range again, 125% to 200% relates to this as well. And lastly, clarifications on enforcing mitigation. The need for coordination with NJDEP water allocation permit program is emphasized. Now that's all on the water deficit reduction. Then I will go into the efficient use of water.
Comments on this? Okay, keep going.
Thank you. The Efficient Use of Water Program. The program summary provides more examples of appropriate methods.
I'm sorry. I did have one question. In Objective 2B8B, when the language changes from proposed increases in consumptive depleted water uses within a current deficit area to new consumptive depleted water uses, can you explain the terminology? Does new, so if you hook into, if the proposal is to have a new consumptive use that would require hooking into an existing system, is that a new use or is that an increase in deficit?
I'm going to let Don answer that.
Typical terminology. We wanted to basically include anything that requires an approval. So if it's a development approval or water allocation approval, it's new, it therefore gets covered. Somebody who already has a permit or already is tied in and is just naturally in ramping up their water use within that existing approval, we didn't want to include under increases in, because then we're monitoring people's daily flows, basically. So that was the idea. So this is new as in new to be approved.
So, okay. My understanding of the allocation, many of the allocation permits, is that they are set at a level which is not totally used, right? That there might be an allocation for X million gallons per day, and that the user, as you just spoke to, is using some portion of that, right? And then and over that time period of that permit for that allocation approval may ramp up to that ultimate capacity that's been authorized.
Right. Okay. So the allocation permits are based on their reasonable expected use within the permit period.
So my question is, if you have a number that's out there that we haven't reached, and already today we're seeing or we're projecting deficits, how have we accounted for that increase? And are we exempting looking at those increases and subjecting them to the mitigation policies and everything else that we have?
If someone has a current approval, then they will not come before the council, at which point we have no ability to impose a mitigation requirement on them. We capture that in two ways. One is we look at the build-out analysis, especially the local build-out, to determine how much of that permitted capacity they actually have a likelihood of using. And it might be much less than they originally thought. But you set that. And then the water use and conservation management plan is the venue for capturing that issue and figuring out how that affects the deficit and what you want to do to mitigate it. So there's a difference between project-by-project mitigation based on a new approval and sub-watershed-based mitigation based on the existence of deficit.
And so if we use the language increases in or new, will we capture both of those and have the opportunity to review them on a permit-by-permit basis through agency coordination with DEP or other water supply entities?
Well, if it requires a DEP permit that we have some interaction with, then it's new. And we will definitely include it. The water allocation issue is a little bit different because there is the requirement of the Act that their decisions not be inconsistent with the regional master plan. So there's a connection which in the long run, you know, let's say somebody had currently an allocation for an additional million gallons of water, and the build-out analysis shows that they're only going to need a quarter million gallons of that. At the next water allocation permit process, at the very minimum, DEP has to consider that in their decision.
Right. I guess my concern is that the trigger becomes, well, the Highlands Council is only supposed to look at new uses or new consumptive uses, not increases. John's got much more experience than I do in how these word games are played, but I don't
understand.
Well,
the thing, as you said this, I mean, so if it said proposed new or increased,
right? I suggest maybe I'll have both in there as opposed to one versus the other.
I guess the question would be if somebody already has a permit and they already have an allowance for certain, it's a development, and they're in the process of developing, every time they add a house to the connection, they're increasing use. But they already have an existing permit for connecting all of those houses to substitute that says.
Right, well, so but use a different example, like single-family houses. How about there's an industrial user out there, or a golf course, that I can think of, that has not gone to that fully allocated use, and yet we're seeing deficits in that watershed, or other expressions of the lack of water. Don't we want to have the ability to influence that and subject that to these policies? I'm saying I don't want to create jurisdictional loopholes by the way to use the language, the things that might affect our goals of this plan get left off the table.
Right. And that's the purpose for the Water Use and Conservation Management Plan, is to capture those issues and put in place the mechanisms for making the mitigation happen on a sub-watershed basis. And some of that's going to happen project by project, and some of that will happen as a long-term or short-term or long-term, depending on the plan.
Right.
But there are things that we will not have any ability to enforce through a specific land use because they already have all of their permits. And yet we still need to deal with the deficit, and that's what the plan is for. So we're trying to capture the entire universe, some cases project by project mitigation, and some cases through the plan.
Can I ask, Tim, if so I hear what you're saying, my understanding from Dan and staff is that our authority to do what we're suggesting here under Objective 2B, 8B is for new consumptive and depleted uses. But I hear what you're saying, and I also understand that we have the right, well, DEP under its rules should not be allowing for increases that are inconsistent with our plan. So could we, and I'm asking as well, add an objective here that would say for increased consumptive depleted use that we would give a recommendation to DEP consistent with the rule.
Let me ask different question. I'm carrying my question, but I mean, could we say proposed increases in approved consumptive or depleted water use shall occur? I mean, so if it's already approved, you're saying we don't have. No one's going to care about our opinion.
Right. If it's already approved, that it's past DEP.
Right.
They can't revise the permit.
So this is meant to apply to those instances that are not already approved.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so Tim's point is that could be a new facility. It could be an existing facility that's increasing its use.
Right.
In a way that requires DEP approval.
And if it requires any DEP action, then it would be considered a new use.
Well, then new isn't clear. I agree with Tim.
All right. Then maybe what we can do is go back and make sure that we capture that, if you will, permit modification potential.
Right.
That's perfectly reasonable.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
Thanks.
Right. Okay. I had a question before. Are we done with the section then of water deficits? You're going on to the next.
Yes.
Okay, I had a question related to Objective 2B4D, which reads the highest priority for agricultural water uses in the conservation zone shall be those preservation area uses that promote agriculture and horticulture that are compatible with the protection of highlands environment. And then the second part of that sentence says, and those planning area uses that promote the continuation and expansion of agricultural, horticultural, recreational, cultural uses, and we say it should minimize consumptive water uses, but we don't repeat the language about compatible with protection of the highlands environment.
I'm sorry, Tracy, this is the next. This is under, I know these two are connected.
Oh, okay. That's why I was wondering, because
yeah.
They're attached.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
But I know exactly.
Okay. Well, we can. That question can come up as
okay.
We go on.
So let's make the transition to the efficient use of water.
Right.
Okay. And I will then speak to that. Efficient use of water program. This is the same document you've been using. Program summary provides more examples of appropriate methods to enhance efficiency of water use. Policy B4 and new objective 2B4. Clarify the importance of efficient water use in all situations and the importance of water use availability and efficiency for compatible agricultural water uses. This came about because of the council discussion. This is what you were just referring to, Tracy. What we had there before, the language that was in place before spoke about efficient use of water, but completed and it said consumptive and completed water uses for non-ag uses shall be stringently limited. And at that council meeting, we were told, wait a second, and quite correctly, so we changed the language to make it sure, to make it clear that in all situations, that was important. Then we changed the language for compatible agricultural water uses to reflect specifically what is in the Highlands Act, because the Highlands Act talks about in the preservation area, the actual words from the Act are promote agricultural and horticultural uses and opportunities that are compatible with the protection of the Highlands environment, etc. The planning area language from the Act specifically states that promote the continuation and expansion of agricultural, horticultural, recreational, and cultural uses and opportunities. That's specifically taken from the Act, and that's why we did it, because as we were talking about it with staff, we went back to the Act and said, let's just take it straight from the Act, so that the use of the word compatible is only as it is in the Act, expansion only as it is in the Act, applying to preservation and planning. We limited, and we can come back, of course, if the council wishes. We limited modifications to reflect GPO changes and links to water deficit reduction program and to provide more specifics regarding water loss reduction methods and irrigation efficiencies. The discussion of water transfers between sub-watersheds provides more detail on transfer limits and the potential role of beneficial water reuse. Requirement for water use and conservation management plans for all sub-watershed is stated, with the potential for combined plans and cooperative planning efforts. And finally, the deficit mitigation requirements are provided in more detail, including thresholds for mitigation prior to initiation of a depleted consumptive use. That's all on this.
We're still in a place, though, where we would be granting or passing judgment on allocations and increases in waters in deficit areas prior to the resolution of the deficit.
In some cases, yes. It was that range that we gave you.
Right.
There was some cases yes, and in some cases no.
Well, where's the some cases no? Just to be clear, because I didn't think that was absolutely clear. And large, when you say in the large ones.
Yes, we had a. I don't know if it's in this. I don't believe it was in the GPOs where we and we did the white paper that described that there was a table.
Right.
That, yes, that's that we're still working under that.
Okay. So are you saying that the mitigation program has to be started, or the reduction of the deficit has to be achieved?
It depends on where you are within that scale.
In any place. In the large deficits, you have to actually achieve the deficit.
You have
reduction.
To do it, in advance, you have to do the program and show the mitigation. Yes.
The mitigation.
The mitigation program.
Yes.
You don't have to actually, semantics here, but we had talked in the past about these plans should be put in place and we should be eliminating the deficit before new development goes in. Okay? That's not what you're saying.
No, I'm saying it's on a scale. In some cases, yes. Some cases you do and you have to prove the mitigation in advance. In other cases, it depends on that threshold. Jan, do you want to add?
The important distinction, I think Tracy is making it, between mitigation of the new use and complete elimination of the deficit
exactly,
in the sub-watershed.
Yes.
This right. policy requires for large deficit areas and for large new uses, proof of the mitigation
okay.
of the new use. But it's the water use and conservation management plans that get you at the deficit from a project.
Okay, so it's not actually that we've done away with the deficit.
No.
Just wanted to make sure.
Sorry.
Other comments on this? Okay.
We're talking about the efficient use of water. It probably doesn't belong here, but there are 4.6 million people who get their water from the Highlands area that are not within the Highlands region. You know, and we're asking all the people and the towns within the Highlands region to do a lot of planning and putting in place conservation measures in order to protect this water supply. But we're asking nothing of that other 4.6 million people. And I think that somewhere in our plan, we should state that we recommend that there be legislation passed that would require some level of conservation on behalf of all the people who are benefiting from this water supply.
Right, Mimi. We did discuss this under the water user fee legislation that the council was promoting, because it was a belief then that that kind of charge would get people to realize if there was a cost associated with the water they were concerned. But we can add to that language of
conservation
that portion, the conservation measures, the legislature should encourage those throughout the whole state.
Thank you.
Any other discussion on this section? Let me welcome Kurt Olson, who walked in 4 seconds before we got to agricultural resources program on the agenda. And Debbie and Scott are on the phone. And is anyone else on the phone at this point?
Scott walked in. The next element we'll be looking at is agricultural resources. The agricultural resources program, and the document we will be following is agricultural resources. The issue overview and program summary were expanded for clarification to be consistent with the revisions to those policies and objectives. Program components were rearranged within this. I know it looked complicated when you got it, but they were rearranged to be consistent with the flow of the GPOs. Policy 3B4, and this gets back to the issue we were discussing earlier with the Farmland Assessment Act, and the changes to the language were because of that council meeting where we heard testimony from the public about their concerns about opening up the Farmland Assessment Act. So we changed the language here to support incentives and funding opportunities rather than advocate for the amendment to the Farmland Assessment Act to permit inclusion of credits for the control of, and we have given these examples, invasive species, white-tailed deer reduction programs, and the water value of well-managed agricultural lands. So we tried to broaden it to show that support, but took out the language because of the concerns about the Farmland Assessment Act. Policy E3E3 was revised to state that conforming counties and municipalities should include right to farm provisions in their master plans and development regulations if they have farmland preservation programs or a significant agricultural land base.
Does the Right to Farm Act itself require municipalities to adopt municipal ordinances that incorporate its provisions? Now, so it's like a voluntary element, like many of the other parts of the municipal land use law.
Well, where it comes into play, though, is some of the requirements for getting certain types of funding through the SADC can be linked to a municipality having a right to farm ordinance.
I don't think you can have a preserved farm without a right to farm ordinance, right. At least in Marsh.
No, that's correct. Across, when you do them, you have SADC, you have to have them.
So that's broader, and then this is a couple ways analogous to the COA debate about whether or not we should use conformance with the RMP as a way of advancing those statutes. Right.
Although there is language in the Act that does affirm the Right to Farm Act, and I don't have my copy of the law with me, unfortunately, today, but so I can't quote you the exact language, but there is very specific language in the Act that charges us to affirm the Right to Farm Act in the Highlands region.
Right, but so the question becomes, what's the difference between affirming it or respecting it? Or
maybe affirm is the wrong word. I think we'd have to read what it says in the law.
Jeff's looking it up now. Do you want to move
to Sure. This is language under Section 9C of the Highlands Act. In preparing and implementing a regional master plan or any revision thereto, the Council shall ensure that the goals, purposes, policies, and provisions of, and the protections afforded to farmers by the Right to Farm Act, and any rules or regulations adopted pursuant thereto, are recognized and not compromised in any manner.
Can I move on?
Yeah.
Okay.
implementation of strategies to promote preservation in the agricultural resource area and the agricultural priority areas. That was there before. It was previously called Establishment of Agricultural Preservation Priorities. But now we include the discussion of the potential inventory of agricultural lands. The cluster development section was merged with development of cluster conservation design standards and expanded to reflect clarification and changes to the cluster program GPOs. The section serves as a regional clearinghouse. Previously, it was called Establishment of a Farmland Preservation Stewardship and Technical Assistance Program, was revised to be consistent with Policy 3A8, which was discussed under GPOs. Establishment of alternative innovative agricultural preservation programs was expanded. Again, that's to be consistent with the GPO discussion. The program discussion on impervious cover limitations was expanded to include a brief discussion on the USDA NRCS Farm and Ranch Lands Protection Program. And we felt it was important to include this because this program allows the SADC to leverage farmland preservation funds, because they can get monies from the federal government. But it does require the willing landowner, because this is one of those preservation programs, to restrict impervious cover on the farm through the deed of easement. So we just included that language here. A new program discussion added to specifically address the Right to Farm Act. The council will coordinate with the SADC, which manages a Right to Farm program in partnership with the CADBs. And this was in response to comments received. That's everything in the Ag Resources Program. Yes, sorry, we're on them. The next document is that we'll be discussing historic, cultural, archaeological, and scenic resources, and the slides are divided historic first and then scenic. The Historic Resource Protection Program changes. The program was updated to support the GPOs and expanded to respond to public comments. And we added an item that encouraged alternative strategies such as adaptive reuse. In the Scenic Resource Protection Program, changes again, updated to support the GPOs and expanded to respond to public comments and particularly to provide greater clarity. We added an item encouraging alternative strategies here and an item encouraging municipalities and counties to pursue the designation of scenic byways. The next program, transportation program changes.
Any comments on this dark one?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I have a comment.
Yeah.
You say that municipalities will be encouraged to establish a historic preservation commission or similar entity. Now, commission has a very different connotation and power than does a committee. Some towns really don't like to establish commissions, but they'll establish a committee. Commissions sometimes take on a great deal of power.
I think there's no legal distinction between them. We are a council because somebody in the legislature thought it sounded less intimidating than if we were going to be a commission. But the powers didn't change when that discussion went on.
I'm not sure that's true.
On the municipal level, that's not true.
Right.
If they create a historic commission, they actually have a major on that.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. A committee would be a better substitute.
Okay.
So you want to just change that?
Well, say something, some kind of a historic preservation entity, whatever, but I wouldn't say that you have to establish a commission. some kind of like
committee. That makes it more recognizable, I think. Jeff was pointing out that it does say encourage, but you want us to have...
It is only encourage, but what you're suggesting maybe is to not, you wouldn't want to encourage the creation of the commission, but some body that would deal with protection of historic resources.
Yeah.
So we just find
it in our town, and now we have so we just say, instead of a commission, because it's...
Yeah, and I just...
I think what maybe is suggesting is just change the word commission to committee.
Or could we just make it more general? My suggestion would be something like, you know, establish a body, a municipal body for, you know, historic preservation or something like that, a little bit more generic so that...
That's fine.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll... That's fine.
Municipality chose a commission, a committee, a committee.
So we'll work on language that's generic. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Is there a nomination process in here? I'm skimming through this, trying to find. Wasn't there a nomination process for scenic, or did that disappear?
That was in procedures, and procedures aren't part of the plan. We were going to go back out for public comment on those procedures and other procedures, but they're not actually part of the plan. In fact, we'll be coming back to you. We'll be receiving more public comment.
Because we don't know yet what the scenic resource is yet.
There's been a lot of debate at the Natural Resources Committee about that issue, and so it will be coming back to you, but isn't necessary as part of the adopted plan. It is a separate set of procedures, but you will be deciding. It has not been decided yet.
You will decide what a scenic resource is.
No, well, you'll be deciding what goes into those procedures. Okay, sorry, sir. I'm just looking for my note to myself on transportation.
Hold on.
Okay, transportation program GPO, program changes. And this document is simply named Park-wide Transportation. The program was edited to reflect updated GPOs. Program narrative was edited to include language regarding the 7 regional airport facilities in the Highlands region, scenic corridors and byways, and agritourism. And the program was updated to include additional language regarding the recognition of transportation projects that promote a sound and balanced transportation system consistent with smart roads, strategies, and principles. We had a lot of discussion on this at a previous meeting, and I know that Council Member Olstead in particular has probably noted that those examples aren't there. We had entered into a contract with the 4E Transportation Centre, and we will and we committed to having some projects to put in here for promotion, for priority consideration for this planning process, and we expect the information from 4E Transportation next week. So by the 26th, we will have some of those projects to name for your consideration. So I wanted to make sure I got that, because right now I highlighted and left it missing. And we are continuing to work as well with 4E Transportation, and they have done, they've met their timelines as regards the growth-induced study, so we're continuing to work on that, just to give you an update. Those are the major changes in the transportation program.
Comments on that? Questions?
I did, actually, Jeff reminded me, there was one change in the documents that I had sent out to you. So I feel that I should, and the documents that are in your packet today. So I feel that it's important that the public have it in theirs. And I wanted to make sure that I let you know in the interest of, obviously, full disclosure. The packet, if you look at the second to last page.
Yes.
Where it's of the transportation document, sorry. And if you look, the heading is Overview of Transportation Project Review. After the initial paragraph, it then says, Transportation Project Review will generally
evaluate the following. If you look at number two under that, it, what I sent out to you said, determination of net effect on through lane capacity, as additional through lane capacity is prohibited in the preservation area. We of course work with our state agency partners, and Department of Transportation pointed out that the Act doesn't actually prohibit it. So what we did was we went back to the language in this program, and we changed to say consistent with the requirements of policy 5B3. And 5B3 reads, to prohibit through plan conformance and Highlands Project Review road improvements in the Highlands region in areas for which a growth-inducing study demonstrates that proposed improvements do not support the RMP resource protection and smart growth policies and are likely to be growth-inducing for lands with limited or no capacity to support human development without an adverse impact on the Highlands ecosystem. That was a previously approved policy of the Council, so we felt that that was appropriate to make that change.
I just ask, so what led us to believe in the first place that the Act, that sounds familiar, what was it that we were not interpreting?
There was language in the Act about what projects were not subject to an exemption, and it was the reading of that. Actually, Jeff and I went through this yesterday, so...
Sure. I mean, under the two exemptions that deal with transportation-related projects, basically it says if you're under certain thresholds and for safety projects and the like, those can be exempt or will be evaluated by DEP to determine their exemption status under the Highlands Act, except when they where those projects are going to result in new three-lane capacity. Then they have to go through the full HPAA process with DEP. So I think somehow in the process of these policies getting prepared, that language was somehow pulled in to say that there was a complete prohibition on adding through lane capacity in the preservation area, and that's not the case. That it's a trigger for both full DEP review and review by the Council under Section 16, which deals with capital project review. And we just wanted to make sure that was clarified and that was pointed out by DOT.
Okay. Next document is Land Use Capability Analysis. That's the title of the document. We added language here clarifying that the local build-out process will include the Land Use Capability Analysis using the Highlands Regional Build-Out Model as a tool. Text was added to clarify that water use and conservation management plans will be used to inform the local land use capability analysis. And with regard to extension of water and wastewater utility services, the distinction between the preservation NJDEP waiver only and the planning area is clarified. The cluster program changes. There are three slides on this, and then there are some visuals which the Council asked us to provide. The document we're looking at is cluster/conservation design development. That's the title of the document that you're following now. The program was revised to be consistent with the GPOs. The issue overview was revised to include a general discussion on funding constraints associated with preserving lands through the fee simple and easement acquisitions, and to include cluster and lot averaging provisions under the New Jersey MLUL municipal land use law. Project summary emphasizes that municipalities considering the use of clusters will be encouraged to take a holistic approach to planning for the entire municipality through the plan conformance process. Program summary and general provisions has revised language regarding the developed portion of the cluster project area. This reflects the conversations we had when we were doing the goals, policies, and objectives. We had a change during the goals, policies, and objectives that required that the developed portion occupy no more than 10% of the cluster project area to the extent feasible if served by a public or community on-site wastewater system. So before that, we had the 80% protection. Developed portion was 20%, but we felt that could be tightened if you had a public wastewater system available, or community on-site or public. In addition to smart growth principles, the design of the developed portion of the cluster project shall consider existing community character and LID low-impact development, and both of those are defined in the general provisions. General provisions on non-contiguous cluster and lot averaging are added to be in accordance with the MLUL and to meet the resource management and protection requirements of the RMP. Specific requirements on cluster design were reorganized by the resource target for protection, so in other words, if it's environmental protection or agricultural preservation. Cluster design for environmental protection continues to allow for passive recreational trails, provided they do not disturb habitats for threatened and endangered species, but also requires the trails to be natural landscaped trails constructed of native pervious surface. Where feasible, the trails should link to existing trail networks.
I have a question on that, I totally support the pervious surface. Can you give an example of what native pervious surface would be?
Certainly Dan can do that.
chipping, yeah, wood chipping, local aggregate, things of that nature. You're looking not to bring in a surface that has nothing to do with the highlands region.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Thank you.
Just know it's how to marble.
Or down on the canal towpath where they brought in all this red shale and put it down.
Yeah, let's talk to that. Cluster design for agricultural preservation now requires a deed of easement with language similar to the SADC Farmland Preservation Program easement, the deed of easement and a legally enforceable homeowner's agreement where applicable shall include Right to Farm Act provisions. The applicable is to homeowner's agreement. They shall include the Right to Farm Act provisions. In addition to existing natural features, man-made historic or archaeological features such as rock walls shall also be retained in the developed portion of the cluster. Required setbacks, we had previously required setbacks by LUCZMs, the LUCM zone. We've removed those because these setbacks will not allow flexibility in cluster design to avoid highlands resources and would promote more impervious cover by extending roads and driveways to meet the setbacks. This will be discussed with municipalities during plan conformance. So the idea is that there's more talk here about natural buffers and utilising those and maintaining them, but not putting in under the RMP setbacks. In a discussion with the Pinelands, they had done that initially in some areas requiring setbacks, not necessarily in relation to cluster, but found that what it did was it pushed development back further, added impervious surface. So in conversations with them, they were recommending this kind of approach. It wasn't related to cluster, but they were talking about setbacks and being careful that you didn't push things back and add impervious surface or damage environmental sensitive areas.
So what do you use as the alternative guidance in cluster design? Just the language about minimizing impacts to?
We would work with the municipality, and that again comes back to you for approval of that design ultimately. So we would work on a site-by-site basis, basically looking at what's in existence on that site, retaining natural cover, and then through ordinances work with the municipalities. Do you want to add anything to that, Dan?
Yeah, just a couple of thoughts. One is community character means a lot when you're doing clusters. If you're clustering up to a village setting, the use of extensive setbacks could actually damage that village feel. So in those cases, you probably want the houses a bit closer to the road. In other cases, you need to be able to avoid resources so you can move it a different direction. So those kinds of issues would come up on a side-by-side basis.
Yeah, again, I don't disagree with any of that. When you talk about setbacks, you're talking about sort of traditional lot and lot, well,
setbacks, mm-hmm. in addition to the setbacks that we have come up with about avoidance of intrusion on the environmentally sensitive areas. So
that's correct.
Okay. And I understand the idea. I mean, the first part makes much more sense to me about if you have a village design, putting it, you know, when I live in a village, I live in a narrow lot up against the street, that type of thing. But, you know, how do you guide the design of the cluster? It can't be simply blank slate and then we get into a negotiation. There ought to be some guidance about the avoidance of, you don't want them siting it up against the edge of the wetland, the transitional areas, or in the areas of contiguous forest, that type of thing. And there are. How do we express those policies that are in here already if we don't use quantified standards?
The first paragraph there reads, all development in the cluster project area shall be designed to protect the most important resources, i.e. agricultural space, environmentally constrained resources.
Excuse me, where are you? Where are you?
Buffer strip setback and protection of natural landscape on page X.
I know, that's hard.
Makes it the last page.
Okay, thank you.
And shall maintain highlands, rural, scenic, and historic character. Setback requirements shall be designed to consider and harmonize the cluster development and the cluster project area with existing development. Then the other aspect of this is that we do require clusters to always go through the low-impact design process. And so, again, that gets you to incorporate those kinds of issues. So one way or the other, they should be dealing with that under those conditions.
Model cluster ordinances do not establish setbacks, but include a basic requirement that individual lots, building structures, streets, and parking areas are situated to minimize the alteration of natural features, natural vegetation, and topography. These parameters will be clearly outlined in the cluster development design guidelines and standards, which will include model cluster ordinance language and examples of model ordinances. Now, the following three slides are some examples, and I'd like to take you, this again was a request from council members. These are locations within the Highlands, so the block and lot, the aerial view, all of that, these are real. This first particular, just to sort of, the black boundary line in each of the following slides shows you the total cluster project area. And then those white lines that you see around other areas, those are parcel lot lines. The total development area of the cluster project, and these are suggested, and also explain each one individually, but that's the red boundary. See where the number 14 is, you can see the red boundary. That would be the total development area. Conservation constrained zone, if there is one, is shown with should be shown with the orange hatching.
Get the lights.
Oh, thanks, Dan. And I can see it. I don't know if everybody else can see that one. Yeah. Thank you. See the hatching there? That shows you the conservation zone. That constrained zone is the orange, and then the black, which you can see here, is just the conservation zone. Preserved open space and farmland, if there is any, is yellow shading. This is constrained land up here, actually. Constrained conservation. This, none of this is constrained. Environmental constraints are green shading. That includes all the different ones, like critical habitat, forest within forest areas, open water protection area, riparian, high significant natural areas, vernal pools, prime groundwater recharge, steep slopes, and wetland protection area. In this particular, this would be on septics. The project area, all of this within the black, is 166 acres. 31 acres over here falls within the protection zone. So we apply the 26.1 acres per septic system. So that would, in that case, it would yield. I'm going to get yield here, one septic. The conservation zone, is 135 acres. And that's at 10 acres per septic. So the yield is 13 septics. So the total septic yield for this particular
area is 14 homes. Now, you have to look at this as well, because what we make sure that we've discussed before is there's no bonus density, so you're constrained by the septic yield, and you're constrained by what would be what would happen under a conventional subdivision in this area. 80% of the cluster project area is preserved as agriculture. 20% of the cluster project area here would be developed. It's a rural area with no existing utility infrastructure area. There are, in this case, no prime ag soils, and there is a preserved farm directly across the road. So if you're looking at this, if you did a conventional subdivision, there's the potential, you have to do further work on this, but the potential, and it would constrain this this cluster, to develop 14 homes. So you could divide this all up into large lot zoning for 14 homes, or under the cluster provision, place them here, and therefore, through D, protect all these other areas. Do you want me to continue, John, through the next two?
Yeah, why don't you do that?
This one is the same piece of land, but in this case, the council would be considering an on-site package plant. So all the conditions that I described to the last slide are the same here, except that now we're considering a on-site package plant, and that has led to 90% of the site being protected, and the developed portion then is only 10% of the site. The final cluster scenario is on sewer. Again, this is an existing area within the Highlands. The total project area outlined here in the black is 279 acres. It all falls within the conservation zone, and therefore the septic yield would be 27 septics. Now, this would be an extension of sewers, what you'd be considering here. There is adjacent development on sewer, so you're extending the HDSF, the Highlands Domestic Sewerage Facilities, from this existing area served into this parcel. All are prime ag soils, so you could put your development here and protect 90% of the project area under this scenario. Again, no bonus density. It's based on the septic yield and conventional subdivision. Those are the three examples.
Questions, comments?
I have a question. In the instance where you have the sewer and the 10% of the land is being used for the developed area, the 90% is preserved, right?
That is correct. And as we pointed out in the earlier slides, depending on whether it's an agricultural or environmental, there'd be different, like easements. And so in this case, if this was for agriculture, the easement we spoke of earlier in working with SCDC.
And the one on septics, we said, if I remember right, we were just talking about trying to encourage it to go on to 10%. Septics or package plant?
Not septics.
Okay,
only package plant. We would encourage, where feasible, to get to the 10%. Yeah, in this case, this is the septic, then it was 80%.
Okay, so let's take the package plant, and let's say it did fit onto the 10.
That's it then.
Then is 90% required to be preserved, whatever's left, or are we, I think in the discussion last time, it seemed as if that other 10% was sort of a no man's land. Like we were
no,
not.
No, the 90% is protected.
Okay. Thank you.
We're doing the agricultural preservation. Are we making sure that there is a lot attached to the overall property that's being preserved? I assume that's going to be an entity that could be sold to another farmer at some point, as long as it's preserved. But are we allowing that one of those 14 lots is linked to that preservation?
You could allow for that, or if there's an existing house there, that could be the large lot owner.
I guess my question
is,
are we requiring that a building unit be with the preserved land?
I don't think we have required that, but is the potential there? Yes, so like under an open lands ratio type that you're describing. So I think we're leaving it open dependent on that particular cluster. Dan, do you want to add? I'm sorry.
Yeah, it also depends on what mechanism is used to create the cluster.
I'm just talking about...
If this is a municipal land use law cluster development, then the land must be owned either by the homeowners association or the municipality, at which point there would be no building on it. If you use lot size averaging, then you would probably leave the farmhouse, if there is a farmhouse there, on it. And in fact, in this example, that's exactly what we did. Just to the sort of southwest of the 14 there, that's the farmstead right there. And so the farmer and the farmstead would be associated with the agriculturally preserved parcel, and the 14 units would be on their own. The number of possibilities are endless, because if the municipality wanted to have a situation where the farmer across the road is the one farming the preserved property, then having one of those houses attached to that property would work, because that's not how it's going to come out. So we leave it open.
But typically, when you preserve for agriculture, if this were just being preserved as an agriculture, the requirement would be one building unit would be attached to that preserved property to make it an economic unit. I mean, that would be, I know CMTV would not entertain preservation without it. I'm just wondering that by not requiring one of those units to be attached to that preserve area, are we not, in fact, doing ourselves a disservice? I don't know where this is, but let's assume that this is the last large piece, for argument's sake, in a town. You may want to create an environmental unit for the farmer there, not just a piece of agricultural land.
If it's handled through lot size averaging, that's easy to do and would be appropriate. If it's a municipal land use law cluster, then it would not be possible to do that. It would be preserved in a different fashion. But your point actually makes me realize that we made a mistake on this slide. The farmstead should have been deleted, since it already exists. It should have been deleted from the number of septic systems that you get for the full parcel. Mm-hmm. So that should be a 13 there, not 14.
That's why I offered the caveat that we have to look at these a little closer to make sure the conventional subdivision would allow for that number as well, because it's a further constraint.
So, because I understand this is going to be a proposal that will be coming to us for somebody who's proposing to cross the container. So if they want to include a house for the farmstead, they can do that.
I know what you're talking about, Bill, and we did discuss that amongst the staff as well. We were looking at all the different scenarios that could occur and trying to make sure that we allowed for each, so we didn't dictate it, but we did speak to
that. If you don't make provision for a farmer to be there working on the property, if it's in a big ag area, there's opportunities that exist, that's fine. But if you don't make opportunity for that as part of the project, I think you're doing yourself a disservice, because it's just going to, it'll lay fallow. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's no compelling reason for anybody to do anything to it, but to leave it the way it is.
But you're not suggesting, I don't think, there's a need to require that there be a farmstead preserved.
My inclination would be to require it. I don't know what, again, depending upon the methodology that was used, but if you're going to promote agricultural viability, I think that you need to make provisions for a farmer to be there as part of your decision to use the preservation.
But there are many preserved or farm areas that are farmed. I mean, there are farmers who farm multiple acreages.
Right.
They farm a bunch of preserved areas, or whether or not they're
preserved. And I can only speak to Morris County, but I would tell you there are very few, and the policy was changed, of farms that have been preserved in the county that don't provide for at least one lot to go with the farm because of the viability.
Just to let you know, we did share the materials with Department of Ag as well and incorporated their comments. So I just wanted to let you know that.
But we're not talking about making that change though, right? It was just a thought that, okay. I don't think we should require it. I think we should have flexibility there. I know in my town, one farmer farms several preserved farms, and it would be in his way if there are no rats there.
I don't want to take more time, but if that one farmer gets hit by a tractor and is not around, and there are no other economic ways to parcel up the land because it's all preserved, you're really looking for one replacement for all of that property. It may not happen.
Right. I'd also like to point out that I've seen the instance where that one preserved farmstead ends up being bought by somebody who doesn't have anything to do with farming the property, too. So we can't control anything.
Other comments
on
this? One question. Did you go to the sewer scenario?
Oops. Sorry.
So in this instance, does the I guess that's the northern edge at the top of the picture there. Does that become the new boundary of the sewer service area? So I'm trying to.
I think it would be just the the parcel that is served would be the EAS, just the developed portion of the project, this area,
right.
10%.
And since there's now preserved land between there and sort of the next development opportunity there, yeah, this really becomes the edge of the sewer service area.
Yes.
My concern is that we create a domino that right. The, you know, the new outer edge becomes the new outer edge,
right. Mm-hmm.
As opposed to having to see that it's up close.
Right. That's one of the reasons, Tim, why we wanted to, and it was stated at the beginning of this, is to work with municipalities at the beginning to try to make sure that you don't allow things to happen and then realize that you've blocked opportunities. You need to plan this kind of work up front with them so that you don't have any chance of this leapfrogging effect. Okay.
Other questions on this? Or comments?
Can I ask the lights?
Yes.
It's sort of nice like this.
I find my pen. That's
right. Yeah. Thanks.
Have a bit of church.
Right.
The next program we're going to look at is low impact development program changes, and the document is low impact development program. The program again has been updated to support the GPOs. It has been expanded to provide more details and components to advance the GPOs. We added site design and development process to it, open space and landscaping details, a water conservation section, and we added a stormwater management section with an 80% on-site stormwater capture goal. So this is just to encourage. So that's everything that was in the low impact development program.
I think this section is well improved.
Extras.
Yes.
On the other side.
On the other staff, I'm not taking the point.
And to go back a second, I think the examples you showed before were very helpful. The cluster was something we had asked for, and I think they really helped.
Around the side? No. Okay.
Okay,
thank you very much.
That's
well, and Erica just left the room. Erica Webb, who worked on this, but we'll make sure she finds out along with the team. Sustainable Economic Development Program changes. This document is called Sustainable Regional Economy. The program was edited to reflect the updated GPOs. The program narrative was edited to improve clarity. And discussion was added regarding the requirement for conforming municipalities to develop or amend an existing economic plan element. Now, this is very much consistent with the discussion that was here at the council, in particular, Bill and Mimi, I believe. So we wanted to recognize the plans will vary considerably in scope, depending on the size and composition of a municipality, its current economic conditions, and whether it chooses to grow or not. That's it for... the next document, plan conformance program changes. In order to follow this document, it's... Yeah, the front of it is Chapter 5, Implementation.
Six.
Thank you. And it's Part 1, Regional Master Plan, Conformance, Consistency, and Coordination. This is the second page. This is where they got a little difficult to follow. The program was edited to reflect updated GPOs.
The narrative was edited to improve clarity, and discussion was added regarding the requirement for conforming municipalities to develop or amend an existing economic... Okay. Sorry, thank you.
All sorts of the same.
So how could they possibly argue with this? It sounds so familiar.
Boring.
Plan conformance program changes. Program revisions provide greater detail on plan conformance requirements. This is all being discussed with you before, but we want to include review for regional master plan updates as step number one. It's logical that the first thing we do with towns is say, give us your factual information. Did we get something wrong? Are there more preserved lands? Did we capture your existing areas served for potable and wastewater? So that's the first step, is to make sure we get our information updated. Provide information on the filing of petitions. And clarification here on the planning areas versus preservation areas. We get a lot of questions on this. What's the timing requirements based on the Act? In terms of the planning area, the Act doesn't give any mandated time for consideration of conformance. In terms of the preservation area, for any municipality or county with lands that are within the preservation area, the requirement is under the Act, within 9 to 15 months of adoption of the Act, they have to put their application in for conformance, so they have to have done all the measures. That's why we have the basic conformance, so that we could offer conditional conformance. Also, we put in here notices of intent to petition, so that we can keep track of where towns are, that they have to give us that notice of intent to petition. We discussed Model Highlands supplements in these program changes, Highlands Master Plan Element and Highlands Resource Regulations. Discussed that basic plan conformance, what are the elements of that, and outline the requirements of plan conformance. Okay, that's it for plan conformance program changes. Still within Chapter 6.
Any comments on that section?
Sorry.
I just want to, I guess, kind of put on the record that about the basic plan conformance idea that I think very bad experiences with State Planning Commission or planning enforcement. That, you know, I understand the idea that there are certain initial threshold critical elements that need to be dealt with, and that the process is probably complex and challenging enough in the time frame. But I just want to make sure we don't structure this though, so things get strung out. And we have conditional approvals that avoid some of the harder questions, you know, and that are really, more importantly, I think, central to the protection of the resources. It's just a caution, as we're going through this, to put on the record that I have.
We didn't have a slide on this one because there weren't any significant changes. Project review, subpart A, project review process. Discussion of exemption determinations in the planning area was removed, as staff concluded that these determinations are not RMP consistency determinations that belong in this program. The review standards for each RMP element were updated to reflect changes that were made to individual GPOs and programs. I did want to call out, though, the prime groundwater recharge discussion in this document, it is not before you today. That element is the recommendation will be considered by the council June 26th. I started out the meeting today by bringing that to your attention. Because it's in this document, I don't want the public to think that what they're reading in this document is by any means resolved. It is not. That's going to be coming back for discussion 26, and we'll that will refine this document. Okay, that's everything on
Could you just explain to me the changes in the text under the Highlands Open Waters and the Riparian Area Review Standards? There's a sizable addition in the second paragraph and a sizable deletion. Put it down.
This language is consistent with the goals, policies, and objectives that we discussed this morning. That's what those changes reflect. So I know that you've asked us.
So the deletion about the modifications of the buffer zones is supposed to tie back to this idea of a stream corridor plan. Yep.
Dan, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the whole discussion of 1D4I that we're having before. So. To the extent that any changes are made there, they will wind up being reflected here.
That's the case with any of the changes. That if you make amendments or changes to GPOs, they then get redacted back into the programs. Okay. Now, forgive me. The next slide actually is part of the previous document. So if you go to, chapter 6, implementation, the document that starts federal, state, and regional agency coordination, there wasn't a slide on that, but within the same document, if you go to local participation, subpart D, which is about midway through that document, it starts at the very bottom of the page. There are very minor changes there. So in the public, if you're with me, it's documented on the first page for federal, state, regional agency coordination. Third page in, very bottom, local participation. There were edits to improve clarity. Policy was added to ensure public participation in municipal and county plan conformance activities to require the statutory minimum notice and open public at open public meetings. Remembering, though, of course, when there are any consideration of changes to master plans, there are requirements there for public hearings, not public meetings. All of those still apply. We also encourage community visioning and other forms. Objective added to the regional master plan monitoring policy to include a fiscal impact assessment in the Highlands regional master plan monitoring review report. That's all that was in that section.
Clear? Questions? Okay.
The next item on the agenda is water resources and ecosystem science agenda. We don't have any slide on that, I promise. There are no significant changes to that.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. It's part three, right?
Correct. Part three, subpart A, water resources and ecosystem science agenda.
Okay. We had discussed, and just wanted to raise for the council that I feel that we're missing vote in terms of being able to accurately assess what the impacts to our Cup 14's background nitrate levels are by not monitoring the levels of nitrates through monitoring wells or some sort of monitoring program, perhaps of existing wells, as new developments go in Huff 14. And I mean, I still feel I have a problem with our 2 milligrams per liter for the clustered areas as our target. And I wanted to make sure that there were not changes made that I didn't catch to the science agenda that would require that monitoring.
No changes were made.
Okay.
Right, the next item is EGA Master Plan Monitoring Program. The document will fall on here, Chapter 6, Implementation Part 3, Improvement of the Regional Master Plan, Subpart B, Regional Master Plan Monitoring. Okay,
what?
Sorry, Mimi. It's Chapter 6, Implementation, Part 3, Improvement of the Regional Master Plan, and then it's Subpart B, Regional Master Plan Monitoring. I think you're looking at the right one. It's blue.
You have it. That's it.
You
okay.
Okay. The program was edited to reflect the updated and relevant local participation GPOs, including a reference to a fiscal impact assessment that measures the overall economic health of the region as compared to the rest of the state to be included in the Highlands Regional Master Plan Monitoring Review Report. A program narrative was added to improve clarity. That's all on this one. What did would draw your attention to the preparing the Highlands Regional Master Plan Monitoring Review Report. We stated at least every 6 years. That way it runs with the life of the Highlands Regional Master Plan, because we're required to update by the Act every 6 years. We said at least, trying to be reasonable what staff can really accomplish. Okay. Highlands Implementation Program Changes. This is the final slide. It is Chapter 6 Implementation, Part 4, Highlands Council Implementation Programs, Subpart A, Highlands Council. Priority definitions clarified to indicate that levels do not relate to importance. This is where, in the beginning of this program, we speak about immediate priority, intermediate, and ongoing. It wasn't a question of one thing is more important than the other. It's a question of the time required to do these items. The petition for plan endorsement was added to items of immediate priority because it's required 60 days after adoption of the regional master plan. We are required to petition for plan endorsement for the planning area of the Highlands. State and federal agency coordination was moved to intermediate priority level, and edits to improve clarity and workflow. They were the only changes to this particular program.
Before we turn to public comments, any council member comments on any aspects that we've been discussing?
I'd just like to ask one thing to clarify. The cluster development, that applies only to residential development. We don't allow any non-residential
development.
Their focus has been on residential development. I'm not sure how one would cluster non-residential.
That's it for me. That's what we've done only for residential.
I just think that as resources become more and more scarce, such as gas, we may want to encourage know, little local stores or something, business stores. We can deal with that as we go on. Yeah.
And we can use the redevelopment opportunities through the Act as well to do some things.
Before we get public comment, I just want to reiterate our schedule going forward. So, as I said at the beginning, but our next meeting after today is 2 weeks from today, June 26th at 4. Then our next meeting is 2 weeks after that, July 10th at 10. That meeting, as council members, to the extent possible, to before that meeting, to circulate amendments you're considering making to Eileen and me, at least, and the rest of the council, like that we could at least ask questions about at that meeting, July 10th, and without voting on them. And then on our next meeting after that would be July 17th at 10, where we will consider adopting the regional management plan with any amendments council members want to suggest. Is there anyone from the public who'd like to speak? Who hasn't spoken to the council before? Yes, sir.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and council members. My name is Tom Collins, believe it or not. I'm an attorney and a professional planner with the firm of Ogletree, Collins & Snyder in Morristown, New Jersey. I also have a joint degree in Master's in City and Regional Planning and Law. I represent a number of municipalities in the Highlands region, and in particular, Hardyston Township and Byram Township have asked me to express on their behalf some objections to a recently proposed policy of the Highlands Council. I think you're going to consider it on to the later June meeting. We object to the proposed policy of making the RMP standards mandatory for water quality management plans in the planning area. This proposed policy is much too extreme and overreaching. It is also ultra vires of the Highlands Act and the NJDP regulations under the Act, and it's inconsistent with the intent and purpose of both the Act and the regulations. The Highlands Act does not authorize Highlands Council to negate or determine sewer service areas in the planning area, only in the preservation area. Based on the Act itself and common principles of law, you should not do something indirectly that you have no authority to do directly. The RMP is incorrect in the case of both Byram and Hardyston, in that it seeks to unacceptably map protection zones at areas which will prevent the townships from COA compliance. It will prevent the townships potentially from obtaining acceptance certification from the Council on Affordable Housing, even though both sets of plans are fully consistent with COA rules and fully consistent with Round 2 requirements, and the towns are petitioning for Round 3 and will be able to comply if the regional master plan is properly adopted. An example of this is that the village center zone of the Byram Township is the focal point of over 10 years of smart growth planning, funded by and approved by the Office of Smart Growth and the State Planning Commission. It is totally consistent with the State Planning Commission recommendations and requirements under center designation. It is totally consistent with the State Planning Commission endorsed Sussex County Strategic Growth Plan. The RMP for the planning area in this area of Byram would prevent continuation of the Smart Growth COA design principles. It could potentially force higher density housing in other sections of the township center, which is totally unacceptable to my client. Your water quality management policies should not be mandatory in Byram or any other municipality's planning area. Your policy could help future builders remedy plaintiffs against municipalities like mine. In Hardyston, the village center zone and proposed township center are also the locus of the COA compliance. Substantial affordable housing credits have been achieved and are fully approved in the village center and the township center. A form-based code has been adopted consistent with smart growth planning principles. Hardyston Township will be negatively affected by any Highlands Council effort to mandate planning area water quality management plan standards and mapping. Both of these municipalities have detailed their objections to you and your staff as to the RMP and the mapping. Please don't wait, make these municipalities wait for corrections, map adjustments, or plan conformance to have their municipal master plans and ordinances that are smart growth principles effective through the regional master plan. Moreover, the Highlands Council proposal to mandate water quality management plan standards in the RMP is inconsistent with your own written promises and NJDEP regulations and responses to comments by NJDEP to its own Highlands rules. You may remember that in 2006, Hardyston Township adopted a resolution explicitly asking the council, the Highlands Council, for written verification that the township sewer service area approval will not be modified in any manner as a result of the Highlands Master Plan without the consent of the municipal governing body. That resolution was properly transmitted to the Highlands Council, and the Highlands Council, through its executive, Mr. Weingart, responded and said, among other things, I'll quote a few, but I'll try to be brief. One of the specific issues raised in your letter is whether municipalities in the planning area, which choose not to opt into the Highlands Regional Management Plan, will still somehow be indirectly required to come into conformance with the plan. This concern has been expressed to the Highlands Council by a number of municipal officials, and the council has repeatedly tried to be clear that it has no intention of mandating conformance where, by reason of the terms of the Highlands Act, conformance is clearly voluntary. In fact, the Highlands Council adopted a resolution on December 15, 2005, enclosed, to emphasize this position. There is nothing in the Highlands Act or in any existing statutory regulatory mechanism that allows the Highlands Council or any other state entity to mandate conformance with the regional master plan. And the chairman, John Weingart, wrote that letter and also stated similarly that it was really the municipality's option to opt in the planning area.
What's the date of that well-written letter?
What's the date of that letter?
That date is letter is August 15, 2006. And to help highlight that, John Weingart stated, and I think this is correct and the correct statement, that the result of this distinction, the distinction between state plan endorsement and Highlands Plan conformance, is that a municipality outside of the preservation area will have the ability to choose to participate in the Highlands Plan conformance process and will be required to incorporate and implement any standards that are required as a condition of conformance. This is the overriding general policy that the state has been promoting and the Highlands Act explicitly authorizes and requires. And this policy was further explained by the DEP when they adopted some regulations implementing the Highlands Act. The regulations on their face have language, but the response to the regulations is very important in this particular area of the DEP regulations, which one of the responses specifically states that the Highlands Act divides Highlands region into two parts, planning and preservation areas. It's a quotation from page 29 of those responses. The department's rules only apply in the preservation area. There is no evidence that enactment of the department's rules in the preservation area will result in an adverse economic impacts to towns in the Highlands. Rather, the department's economic impact statement predicts positive impacts resulting from the implementation of the department's rules. The commentator may be referring to the planning area when expressing concerns about high-density developments. The department's rules do not apply to the planning area and do not provide subsidies for any projects in the Highlands region. The Highlands Council is preparing a regional master plan that will address planning issues in the Highlands region. As a result of the RMP, towns in the planning area will have the choice to opt into the plan. they will retain the right to decide whether or not they will accept increased development and evaluate themselves whether there are economic benefits to be obtained or environmental features to be protected by opting in to the RMT. Those are the DEP's own words, and they similarly said the same thing about regulation item 1.1K about wastewater management planning. And they specifically said they are not making them mandatory, they will not make the water quality management planning requirements mandatory in the planning area. So, with those key quotes, I think you can see that we, at least on behalf of Byram Township and Artisan Township, we urge you to change your vote on the policy you considered at the last meeting and to not adopt it that way in your late meeting in June. We also urge you to look carefully at the regional master plan mapping for our two municipalities and to correct them now before adoption of the regional master plan so that this issue can become a non-issue. I don't think you should make municipalities like this wait for plan conformance or wait for map adjustment, and this is all the more reason why you should do that correction to your map immediately rather than after adopting a formal regional master plan. In my opinion, as a planner and attorney, the regional master plan is, and its mapping are not ready for adoption, and you must focus more carefully on individual municipalities' master plans and ordinances, which have, in, at least in my municipality's cases, and they're more than just Byram Hardyston, they've been done very carefully to comply with the state plan and with smart growth principles. And those are your charge as well in doing the regional master plan because of the distinction between the planning area and the preservation area. So thank you.
Thank you,
Madam.
Yes.
It's been a while, but I'm sorry to be back. David Trost, Sparta Township. I'm the Director of Community Development and Services. I would like to echo Mr. Collins' comments. Sparta Township objects, more than object, we strongly object to requiring that Sparta be forced to opt in the planning area. And that gets to a comment that I'm going to make, not to individuals, but as the body here, because I don't want anyone to take offense personally. This whole process is about trust and integrity. Sparta Township openly accepted the Highlands Act, specifically with the preservation area, with the knowledge that we would be able to interact with staff and with this council on whether opting in was good for the municipality or not. Now you're taking that right away. Now we would say we object to the whole plan, and we're taking steps back rather than forward. And that's crazy. Time is of the essence to come to decisions on what our future is going to be as a region. And creating more controversy does not get to that point. And I'm urging you to go back to the intent of the legislation. Go back to the trust that was established early on, because I see that trust being broken. And let me tell you, you're only dealing with me. I got to go back and explain this to a governing body, to a planning board, to a zoning board, and to the public of Sparta. You're not there. You're not dealing with the public of Sparta. Unfortunately, I am. And if you've been following the paper, Sparta just went through a very, very difficult election. And had to do with regional issues. I don't think you want to start upsetting the apple cart again and having that spill into this group. On a more targeted conversation, I would also urge that you look at the mapping changes that Sparta has again submitted. We've submitted those mapping changes on numerous occasions. Your maps are wrong. They're absolutely wrong. You're creating zones that do not reflect existing conditions. And that's planning 101. We will meet with you, which we have. We will try to provide corrected data. I hear that you're going to have all these review of individual projects. I've been doing this for 18 years with boards. I don't know how you guys are ever going to operate with all what you want to do. You're going to be here every day of every month determining what is and what isn't with the master plan. Either that, you're going to have to rely on staff, and based on what our governor is doing, he's cutting. I don't know how you're going to operate. I really don't. It worries me. Either what's going to happen is there's going to be a backlog of applications that will not be heard for years, or you're going to make hasty decisions. And that's never good. The end result is not going to be positive for the Highlands. It's not going to be positive to for the environment. It's not going to be positive to the economic development of the state. And it's not going to be beneficial to the residents of this area and to the state as a whole. So I would urge you, first of all, to drop the notion that the wastewater management standards apply to the planning area, and I would urge you to please try to get back on track with the plan. To me, in hearing today, you're trying to micromanage stuff to a point where you're never going to get done, and that's not good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to make a comment that I hope the mapping changes, as far as requested, that we have them and have reviewed them and will reflect them in the plan if they turn out to be correct and valid.
I mean, as you know, we have a process for updates and adjustments, which we're refining through the development of the plan. And what we have done is Roger Kerrin, who's the director of GIS, is putting together a database of towns that have put in requests. The difficulty here is that whether the request is actually an update, which is actual information correction, or whether it's an adjustment, which is sort of a difference of opinion of the actual mapping. So those that are actual information in their updates, we need certain information in a specific format, and we're formulating that and working with you on that as well. So we will work with them, but the thing is that some of the information we've got is sort of a narrative form from some towns. I'm not speaking about Sparta in particular, but so we have to make sure we get it. You know, telling us that it's local knowledge that there are pipes here doesn't help us in a GIS format to verify the information. So we have to be very careful. We are setting forth a process, and we will be able to do that and through getting the information in correct format and then responding.
I just hope that somebody touches base with Sparta to see.
Well, Mr. Collins said the same thing about Harsh and Byron, but I think the course we're on is not, we're not going to be able to make those changes before July 17th.
No.
Much as that might be desirable.
Oh, we will.
Okay. Yes.
Elliot Ruga, New Jersey Highlands Coalition. And Scott, I hope you are on the phone so I don't have to corner you at the Kellogg Club pool this weekend.
I hear you, Elliot.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and council members, I want to thank the council members for their majority vote at the June 5th council meeting to deny the council staff's recommendation to adopt the DEP statewide nitrate dilution standard for water quality management plan consistency reviews for non-conforming municipalities. That was the absolute correct decision for several reasons. Allow me to begin with quotes from the Act. Quote, the goals of the regional master plan with respect to the planning area shall be to, one, protect, restore, and enhance the quality and quantity of surface and ground waters therein. Two, preserve to the maximum extent possible, not practicable, possible, any environmentally sensitive lands and other lands needed for recreation and conservation purposes. Three, protect and maintain the essential character of the Highlands environment. Also, to comment upon any application for development before a local government unit on the adoption of any master plan, development regulation, or other regulation by a local government unit or on the enforcement by a local government unit of any development, regulation, or other regulation, which power shall be in addition to any other review, oversight, or intervention powers of the council prescribed by this act. Further, to prepare and transmit to the Commissioner of Environmental Protection.
You don't need to read the act, could you just summarize your comments?
Well, I mean,
I think you got to the part of the act that was relevant to the point you're making, if I understand the point correctly.
I find that some council members may not be familiar with the act.
How much more of the act are you going to read?
One more paragraph.
Okay.
To prepare and transmit to the and these are relevant to the Commissioner of Environmental Protection such recommendations for water quality and water supply standards for surface and groundwaters in the Highlands region or in tributaries and watersheds thereof, and for other environmental protection standards pertaining to the lands and natural resources of the Highlands region as the Council deems appropriate. The phrase, as the Council deems appropriate, provides broad discretion. What does it mean? Does it suggest the council should cherry-pick a couple of bright-line items to negotiate in internecine turf wars with competing agencies? I interpret that language as enabling the council to be as protective of our highlands without compromise. Quote, the regional master plan shall include, but not necessarily be limited to a resource assessment which determines the amount and type of human development and activity within the ecosystem of the Highlands region, which it can sustain while still maintaining the overall ecological values thereof, with special reference to surface and groundwater quality and supply, unquote. It was the Council's own science, using diligent, well-documented methodologies, the best data available, the best tools, the most dedicated and driven staff, that the Council developed the Land Use Capability Series of maps with a singular focus on the Highlands' unique characteristics and how they affect our water quality and quantity, and formulated a zone-specific septic density threshold. These were to be in your quiver of guidance standards when making findings of consistencies of municipal WQMPs. So why will you be making findings of consistencies in the WQMPs of non-conforming municipalities in the planning area? Allow me to answer that with a rhetorical question. How many HUC 11s or HUC 14s in the Highlands end at the boundary of a non-conforming municipality in the planning area? The answer may be found in a quote from the Act, worth repeating. But maybe I'll skip to the bottom of it, or the last phrase in it. Your recommendations to the DEP to protect the waters of the Highlands and other environmental protection standards pertaining to the lands and natural resources of the Highlands region as the Council deems appropriate. As a society in general, we are rapidly approaching, if not already in, a period of difficult transition. Our economy and our governmental budgets are dismal. Our entrenched reliance on fossil fuels is a tremendous burden financially, and the prognosis on its cumulative effect on our environment is not very promising. The Highlands Regional Master Plan is an eight ball in terms of the future sustainability of much of New Jersey. I certainly appreciate the magnitude of the decisions that you are making, because they will have a considerable impact on whether we end up behind or in front of the eight ball. Thank you.
Thank you.
John, I'm sorry. I just wanted to say something for the record, because I'm a little concerned that I appreciate Mr. Rubin's comments, but for the council just to realize that when you take from certain sections of the Act, I think it's critical that the council consider all of the section. So, for example, there were the resource assessment, which is in section 10 and section 11. In section 11 does finish with the language about where that resource assessment is mandatory and where it is
voluntary, advisory only. Also, the septic density threshold quotation from Mr. Ruger is section 34E of the Act and refers to the DEP regulations for the preservation area. So I'm just concerned that it's too easy to take pieces of the Act. I think it's important to consider the entire Act, and I just wanted to, put that on the record.
Mr. Chairman, though, in all fairness, people who testify in front of us offer their perspectives on these issues. We have been briefed by our own legal counsel as to where our legal authority lies, regardless of what the attorneys from the developers, the towns, or the environmental community says. And I hope that that is what constitutes the record that we make these decisions on, not the spin of anybody. So, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. We're going to start editing people's public comments, and let's do it on all sides of the question.
We ask that you try to limit your comments to about 3 minutes, and so far, one out of three people have done that, and I'll try to enforce that more rigorously going forward.
Good afternoon. Sylvia Kovacs, Warren County. I'd like to start out with what we talked about this morning, the restoration of streams in the riparian areas. Having sat on the Municipal Land Use Board, I can't tell you how many problems we had with developers and engineers as it relates to the functional values analysis, in particular with regards to channel integrity. But I do agree with Mimi in particular, when you have municipalities and redevelopment areas, that you really want to do whatever you can to help make a site more appropriately redeveloped. And in particular, to proactively promote restoration of that site. In Hackettstown, for example, next to the Muskie, we have a site that has just a parking lot right up to the river. This is a different animal than when you have a farmer having disturbed land right up to a waterway. May I suggest a definitional differentiation with regards to impervious coverage when you're looking at redevelopment areas and municipalities versus disturbed land as it relates to restoration programs, and to reevaluate objective 1D4I within the two scenarios. I'd also very much agree with Mimi's suggestion that there should be real serious push to have some types of conservation measures put into place for the 4.6 million people that use Highlands waters that do not live in the region. With regards to plan conformance, I'd also like to agree with Tim in particular with regards to being very careful as to how you allow or disallow conditional approvals. Again, having sat on the Municipal Land Use Board, I can't tell you the problems we've had with conditional approvals and the possible administrative nightmare that you might end up having trying to follow up on whether or not those conditions have actually been met, as opposed to appropriately making the hard decisions up front. Very quickly to the last point, with regards to what Bill brought up on the cluster components of the farmland, I too agree with him that you really should be looking at having at least the option of a proposed building site to go along with that farmland parcel of the cluster development, in particular if you're going to try and really proactively promote more farmers coming onto different parcels of land. Thank you very much.
My name is Deborah Post. My half-century-old apple trees, typically hale, hardy, and enduring, have recently been complaining of voodoo-induced pains and illnesses. I demand that the apple tree's likeness be removed from the wall of this council's hallway, where the environmental witch doctors of this council's staff daily inflict their voodoo torture. The farmland assessment statute has absolutely nothing to do with the Highlands Act. If the tax incentives this council proposes for environmental stewardship are worthy, they must stand on their own with a separate, distinct, and new property tax assessment law. If you can't get a new tax law passed, then it's not worthy. Do not rape the farmers again by tampering with farmland assessment. It's out of bounds, guys. I personally take offense to the comment earlier in this meeting that implied public comment was laughable and did not rise to the level of planned amendment recommendations. And I reiterate that comment on the most recent thought that all we're doing is spinning. I wish I had contaminated my farmland instead of taking good environmental care of it. Brownfield owners get lots of financial incentives, don't they, to clean up their contaminated mess. Towns get grants to spin their wheels on studies that will never happen. But those who have taken meticulous environmental care of their land get no grants, no monies, and are asked to bear all the costs of this process. And then to jump through waiver hoops that are designed to be too exorbitantly expensive. To provide negative incentives for good environmental stewardship, as this council has done and proposes to continue to do, is the worst thing you could do for the environment. It is basically armchair greenie idiocy. The water efficiency rules appear to only apply to Highlanders' use of their own Highlands water. When Highlands water is shipped to the suburban east, they are free to flush 80% of our water out to sea. All this expensive planning process is for naught as it relates to Highlands water. But we all know it never had anything to do with water, don't we? Just the creation of a public park for the rich and the elite.
Christine Hepburn, I'm a resident of Madison. I tend to do apologize because I'm not an expert in any relevant fields. I'm a psychologist. I know that doesn't help. But I'm not apologizing because I am one of your constituents. I know you have several and several are opposed to each other. I come from the, I think, large, though quiet group of average citizens who were pleased to see the Highland Act enacted and want it implemented. People like me care very much, of course, about our water supply, but also they care very much about the agricultural, you know, the rural character that we do have left in this state, not to mention the farmlands themselves. And I've always been bothered by the clustered provisions. It was great seeing actual examples. And I think a lot of the language is great, the things you've done with cluster, the things you said. But when you look at that example of the septic case and you see this preserved farm on one side of the road and all this green stuff on the other, behind the actual farmland, and you see that what's going to be done is taking about 40% of the actual, looks like, tilled land and put 14 homes on it. It just, you know, a non-planner that I am just says, you know, what kind of large regional plan that I think wants to preserve our rural character and our actual farm capacity, what would plan, you know, what does it make sense to put 14 houses there? I mean, I just think there has got to be a better place to put them. And it's very disturbing to me that we're going to allow that kind of cluster development. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Monique Purcell, Department of Agriculture. Two quick things. Regarding the discussion about flexibility and buffers, I just wanted to say that I think it's very important that the council keeps in mind how significant that is. Mamie's points were good ones. Having flexibility when it comes to buffering a region or an area as opposed to a site-by-site plan, I think really makes a lot of sense. I think if the DEP even had their way, they would prefer a regional plan for buffers as opposed to just a site-by-site plan. And when the confusion comes up or the concern comes up about what's the backstop, I think the backstop is maintaining functional value. And that's a very difficult thing to do. Functional value looks at several things. It looks at temperature, water temperature.
both the channel integrity, species, and wetlands buffers. So trying to maintain all four of those things by intruding on a buffer area is very difficult in the first place. So I think allowing any flexibility to allow for a regional plan makes a lot of sense. The second thing is, I just want to thank the staff for illustrating how clustering would actually work on the ground. I think that they were good examples to show really what we're all trying to get to. And I think that is the way to remain, you know, to actually maintain our rural landscapes. I mean, that's the only way we have. And when we talk about commercial, Mimi, about how do we get to commercial clustering, I think TDR receiving areas would be one way to do that, to be able to have that opportunity. So I think it's significant. I think it's critical to the plan. And I just wanted to thank staff for actually showing some real life examples of those.
Thanks. Linda Fry, New Jersey Conservation Foundation. Lots of issues today. I'd like to talk a bit about the first paper, the forestry issue, forest resource management and sustainability. The issue about Objective 1C2D, which originally included language about the farmland assessment program, I think it should be remembered that the farmland assessment program is not just supposed to be about farmers. It's supposed to be about public values. And so, therefore, I don't think it should be considered immune from changes that would enhance the public value aspects of the plan, of the Act. So I think that the language should be stronger in this objective than it currently is. At the very least, it should say support legislative and regulatory incentives and provide funding opportunities for demonstrating and maintaining intrinsic forest values. I think it, you know, it just needs to be a stronger statement than it is right now. The second issue is the stream buffer restoration issue, stream buffer plans. I agree with Sylvia that basically I think what needs to be changed here is the language about existing development or disturbed land. It should be changed to language that says existing development that includes impervious cover, so that only so that this would qualify areas like perhaps Ms. Lutz is referring to in an existing developed area where you actually have a parking lot and you want to remove it, and the areas that are already developed are within the 300 feet, and by developed we mean there are buildings on it or there are parking lots or there's other kinds of impervious cover. What should not come under this language is farmland. If you have an area that has been farmed, it should not, you know, the farming, of course, can continue, but it should not be exempted in a plan from potentially being restored to the 300-foot buffer with vegetation and so forth, shrubs, trees, and that sort of thing that protect the corridor. So there should be language that distinguishes between these two types of situations that occur in the highlands, in the very different parts of the region, where the requirements really are somewhat different. The third thing I would like to comment on is the in the scenic in the scenic resources aspect, which is scenic. Well, it's basically the only section we've seen today on scenic resources. Part of the program. It talks about the inventory of the highlands resources. On the second page of the scenic section, I think that the council needs to simply say that they have identified the 131 publicly owned scenic resources and delete the word potential. These areas are areas that are already included in the DEP rules for the Highlands Preservation Area. It needs to be extended to the Highlands municipalities in the planning area that conform to the plan. It does not need to be reviewed again. It is not potential. They should delete the word potential, and in the same sentence, it says, having identified 131 publicly owned, delete potential, scenic resources, the Highlands Council will seek to add to it through additional nominations. One would delete the words, evaluate the initial baseline sites, refine the list. The list is publicly preserved lands. It is federal, state, and county conservation lands that are already preserved. It does not include farmland that has an easement or is preserved but is still privately owned. These are publicly owned lands. This is like a no-brainer. So please just include it in as part of the RMP from the get-go. And I would also urge the inclusion of the Musconetcong and the Delaware Wild and Scenic Rivers and the Highlands Millennium Trail, which was designated as a federal Millennium Trail. Those are like such basic no-brainer things that I can't believe that they're still not actually in this RMP.
Your time is pretty much up.
All right.
Julia Sellers, New Jersey Highlands Coalition. You've taken a bit of a beating up recently, so I'm going to thank you again. Thank you for posting the build out analysis today. You said you were going to get that up on the website. And are you going to get your slides and materials up today as well? I know that you're in a rush to go and help children graduate, but we really would like to see that happen.
It's actually a child.
Okay. Number two, this will probably never happen again, but I actually agree with Mr. Trost on something. He's not here to hear me say that. But I agree that you have too much to do. And for that reason, yet again, we beg you to drop mitigation in water deficit areas. They're going to make your lives impossible. To also keep the buffers simple along streams. So that you spend as little time as possible reviewing functional value analyses. I agree completely that with poor FEAs along streams, if you differentiate between impervious cover and agricultural disturbance, you really get at what you're trying to get at. But there is, we have learned in, through experience that there is tremendous potential for damage and undoing what you're trying to do, but for including agricultural disturbance in a general term of disturbance, what you're really trying to get at is redevelopment. And I think that it's very important that you do that. Thank you for the cluster examples that you showed. It was a wonderful exhibition of how cluster might work next to existing community zones and how it's going to be really problematical when it's unsettled. Thank you very much.
My name is David Chauvin. I'm a Farm Bureau member. And this is a 6-foot ruler. The amount of water that falls in New Jersey on the average is this, about 46 inches. The amount of additional water that falls in the Highlands
is about this. We're talking about 2.5-3 inches. This is the amount of water that you are proposing to take all but this much of my equity away and other landowners in the preservation area to fool with this amount of water. This is called science. It's also in the form of a ruler. Now, one might ask, why are you doing this? I'm glad you asked. Because what happens with the water that falls in the highlands is up, and I submitted this to you in the past, I'll submit it to you again, and for any member of the press who wants a copy of it, I have extra copies. This is what happens to water that falls in the highlands areas as it goes south and east of here. Up here where the water falls in the Raritan River system, it's all nice and green. Green is good. As the water goes, same water, with the addition of polluted water as it runs to the south and east of here, it gets redder and redder. The reason why this water is so important is to dilute your pollution. It's as simple as that. This is reflected in the U.S. EPA studies of ocean water. Also, I'm going to submit with you today the fact that you guys are doing good work. Middlesex Water Company, in their last quarterly report, has raised their quarterly dividend yet again. Good going, guys. Last week, I asked you, Mr. Weingart, if you would release the confidential board and memo so that we could take a look at it, see what you're talking about. I'll ask you again. Also, the targeted property list, some 300 and some odd properties, that is confidential. I think the landowners of this property should be aware of it, at least. And I would consider a failure for you to do so as being allowing me to awarding you 2 gold stars for transparency. The water deficit is a fraud. The way you make a water deficit work is you say 80 or 90% of it, and I'm quoting Van Abs, is set aside for ecological purposes. I think I just told you what the ecological purposes were, to dilute the pollution downstream. This in itself makes it a fraud and nothing more than a tool to accomplish a political agenda designed to force growth in certain areas where they are already suffering saltwater intrusion and stuff like that. Happens to be Senator Smith's area, incidentally. And I can suggest one way of solving these water deficit areas. That's shut down the Pequot fish hatchery. They pump out 6,500 gallons a minute, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Shut it down. This would be the equivalent water use of all of Warren County. Also, in terms of determining buffers, I told you a couple of years ago and submitted what was then the 6th year of a 10-year study of the Stroud Report. This is a U.S. Department of Agriculture study done in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, to assess the effect of adjacent land use on streams. And they were talking about a 35-foot buffer or a 75-foot buffer, not 300 feet. It's science. They measure the water. They see what's in it. The report is available. It's probably pretty close to being done now. And in terms of sustainable economic development, part of you should learn from Eastern Europe. Central planning is not the answer. And also, as part of your economic analysis, you should assess the additional costs in compliance with any plan submitted to the Highlands Council. These are real costs. The applicant, in addition to the fees and all this other stuff that you're going to require of them, has to pay his own engineers, his own lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. All of this serves to diminish the value of the land because if these costs do not fall to to the bottom line in black ink, the plan doesn't get done, and that's exactly the cynical purpose of this act, to make it so expensive that nobody will do it. That's exactly the purpose. And the purpose to me is crystallized in the last waiver, which is a waiver to avoid a taking. In other words, you want to take all but that much. And if you fail in taking that all but that much, you issue a waiver. And those people who are talking about a rural character, this is a crapshoot, because up in this neck of the woods, you will have rural character either one of two ways. You will have it with pretty horse farms, which will be really nice for everybody to look at, and you'll say, ooh, this improves my property values. But if you really want to take a look at the rural character, go to Appalachia. That's where you'll find it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have some great news for the council. I really do intend to be brief. My name is Jim Kilduff. I'm the Planning and Community Development Director for Franklin Borough of Sussex County. We are a planning area community. Recently, your executive director, Ms. Swan, and Tom Boyden, your deputy executive director, traveled all the way up to Franklin at nighttime to make a presentation to our governing body. Unfortunately, the stars were not in alignment that night with the agenda, but I, for one, and I know the council was very grateful that they made that effort. And I think that speaks well for the council, for the Highlands Council, to make those kinds of efforts and to reach out to planning area communities. I'm here because I have a concern now that I've come to understand that some of the interpretations recently with respect to the DEP regulations and the Highlands Master Plan may impact planning area communities to the extent of regulating our land use and prior to those communities opting in. So I ask the council to consider these things, to tread lightly, to be careful about overstepping the boundaries that are spelled out in the legislation. Thank you.
Marion Harris, Morris County Trust for Historic Preservation. I have to tell you that I heard some things this morning that really gladdened my heart. There is a process beginning to emerge about how to deal with historic resources, who is supposed to be handling what, and where things are supposed to go. And this is like watching the sculpture emerge from the marble, and I'm really enjoying it. It is emerging, so that's positive. There will be some more detailed comments if I have anything left in my 3 minutes at the time that I finish talking about something that really you need to get straightened out and you need to have some legal advice about this. And that is the difference between a committee and a commission. There is enabling legislation in New Jersey which says that if New Jersey towns want to do historic preservation, that means evaluate historic resources, that means take action on development applications. They must have a commission, and it must be set up in a certain way, which is spelled out in this enabling legislation. Now, there are two kinds of commission. One kind is regulatory. Those people have a veto. They are indeed scary. And the reason they're scary is that the people who are required to be on commissions are not defined very clearly. So a lot of people on commissions really don't have the experience that they ought to have because they are appointed for political reasons rather than for their expertise. So regulatory commissions are scary. The other kind, which is about 75% or more of the ones that exist in the state, are advisory. They are advisory to the Board of Adjustment and the Planning Board. They are enabled to do historic review, but they don't make any final decisions. And they're not scary. If anything,
they should clarify things, and they do that successfully to the extent that they are chosen wisely, that their members are chosen wisely, so that they can carry out this professional chore, because this is a technical field, and the decisions that are made in it need to be made by people with experience. Which gets me back to the comments that I have about process that you're developing. I think that the standards that will be applied to make the decisions that you talk about will be in the manual. I hope they will, because if they're not there, they aren't there anywhere yet. And that's something that you probably will want to work on. How does the council evaluate suggested resources that are supposed to be included on the inventory? Because the council does not have the authority to do historic preservation. You can't evaluate historic resources. So somebody with that authority, if you want your choices to stand up legally, they have to be made on the basis of real judgment by real people. And I don't think you want to require applicants to hire professional preservationists to come with their applications and tell you whether they have historic resources on their properties. But if they don't do that, their own statements about whether they have them or not are not going to have legal standing, and somehow you're going to have to resolve this question. Is this really a statement of whether the guy has standards or not? Now, I can suggest a mechanism that is used by SHPO to supplement their own overtaxed staff. That is that they have two separate independent advisory committees of professionals. They're professionals in various fields. They're not all just preservationists, but some of them are. One of them is the Historic Sites Council, and the other is the State Review Board. And these people deal with applications that have been reviewed by the staff and recommended to these two committees for their action. Historic Sites Council deals with what you might consider variances. Here's somebody who wants to crap up a historic resource, are we going to let him? And the review board says, is this a valuable resource? Do we want to list it on the register? And these people are unpaid. They do have staff support, but that's another understaffed organization. And this has been working very well, the system, for a long time. And you know who you would like to have on this, because they were people who showed up at your charrette, and their information is all in the technical thing. So that's very good. All right, one other thing I want to say is that I'm pleased to see that there are now some cross-references between the historic section and other sections in the plan. Particularly, you have the cluster, and I saw that it's in the cluster section as well as in the historic section that you're supposed to look back and forth between those things. There are some other references in the historic section. I don't know whether the corresponding main section in the plan says go look at the historic section, but that's something that we've been asking for a long time. Can I talk about one more thing? You are listening. Good. You timed out. We've been talking about the glossary from the beginning and some terms that need to be defined there. I see that the words historic and cultural are still being used like from the outside in. If you remember Sociology 101, a culture is the way a group lives. And it isn't necessarily just a group of people. It can be a group of ants. It can be a group of bees. It can be a group of apes. So culture is the way people live. Historic means it's old and significant. So these are not terms that are... What happens is that historic resources are part of cultural resources. But cultural resources can include things like strip malls and McDonald's and rusting cars in people's backyards that are often less than 50 years old and couldn't possibly qualify as historic. But they are nonetheless cultural resources, and we don't want to protect all of them. So if you're going
to... Not all of them, right?
Well, not all of them. A lot of people say whenever we want to protect anything, you can't save everything. But we're not trying to save those rusty cars. What you have to do is define these terms so that they are, for the purposes of this plan, identical. And then you don't have to talk about cultural anymore. You can just use historic. And I don't think you're going to lose anything if you do that, because if you understand what the background of this terminology is. So that's that. The rest, I think, will go into some written comments, but that's all right.
Thank you.
So this, I think, is progress.
Thank you.
Helen Heinrich, New Jersey Farm Bureau. We're making progress. Marion is happy. But I just disagree that you should take cultural out, because there was a point in the state plan process where cultural was being defined as museums and opera houses and things like that, rather than the way people live. So if we can get that definition in, I would certainly encourage it. Thank you for taking the farmland assessment language out. I think there are a lot of alternatives to set up a separate program to get the money for the stewardship of woodlands, which is very badly needed, but the Farmland Assessment Act is also under scrutiny at the moment, and it's important to every farmer in New Jersey, not just the ones in the Highlands. It's probably the most important thing that happened back in the 60s that made it possible for there to be any farmland left in New Jersey at all. And I can show you a graph that shows that after about 1970, the loss of farmland just kind of leveled off thanks to farmland assessment. So, you know, with all of its faults, it is a law that seems to be working. As far as the cluster discussion, I'm very glad that we saw the examples. I think there's a misperception that they're by allowing mandating clusters in the agricultural area, they're producing huge urbanized little settlements. And I think the application of the septic standards by the zone certainly shows that we're not talking about very many units. And we feel that farmers are skeptical about whether clusters are a good idea in the farming area, and have been for a long time. But also, when you look at what has to be done to create one of these places, there's, you know, six or eight very tough, expensive steps that have to be taken. And for most of them, it comes back to you to decide whether, you know, the project can go forward. So it's got to be either a very rich farmer or a very determined one that would finally would want to go that way, even in with the lack of funding for acquisition or TDR not really working. It's still a huge hurdle to get over. But on the other hand, farmers, we have a nightmare that even the conservation zone is going to be carved up into large lots with great big houses, with you know, minimum amount of agriculture on it. Who knows what kind of farm management? Because the farmer won't have any, even the person doing the farming won't have the management decisions. And we had the problem already of landowners that don't want conservation measures undertaken. They don't want any hunting, so you have a problem of the deer being, you know, an increased problem for everybody else. And so clustering at least will put the houses that are going to happen anyway through exceptions or other to meet the need that we have away from the farms where they can manage it in a more suitable way. And it seems like okay, I know. The one type of
that means you have more time. Sorry. How much? You've been talking for 5 minutes. I'm sorry.
Sorry. Okay. Just one more point. The one kind of land development that is not required to do a plan is the cluster for open space environmental purposes. And why is that? I mean, the forest people have to do a plan. from the agricultural cluster, farmer has to have a conservation plan. It seems like if you're, it's got to be more than just the deed, because you know, those environmental resources need to be managed in a way that fits with the goals of the whole area. And I don't see that in there anywhere.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Steve Kalesser. I live in Highbridge with Gracie and Harrigan Consulting Foresters out of Far Hills. Farmland assessment, in effect, is a very large part of my business. I deal with farmland assessment every day. And I commend the recommendation of this council in leaving farmland assessment out of the discussions previously. And I just want to tell a really quick story just to illustrate that fact. One of our clients came into our office 4 years ago and said, when I cut a tree, it's like cutting my arm off. I do not want to cut another tree down, but I want to get farmland assessment. Okay. We really liked this client, a very personable person. Very small property, but you know, a reasonable person. Otherwise, you know, we really liked her. We really wanted to work with her. So we were able to craft a way within the existing farmland assessment legislation where she was able to have a supplemental type of agriculture on her property and do non-tree cutting forestry activities in accordance with her forest management plan so that she was able to meet the minimum income and minimum activity requirements of the existing farmland assessment law. So we were able to take someone who was absolutely positively, philosophically opposed to tree cutting and maintain their farmland assessment. So, you know, herein we're able to do already what you're proposing to do, and really, you know, you just need the right forester, you need the right person to take a look at that. So I'd much rather see you work within the existing framework than to change the act itself. Two other very brief comments. Objective 1B2A in the Forest Resource Management Sustainability section. I don't understand the difference between number 2 and number 3 in this objective, especially given what I just said. I think it assumes that people who have forest management plans are only interested in logging and commodity uses for the forest, whereas the mere presence of a forest stewardship plan would take the same landowner and suddenly make them only interested in forest stewardship. I just don't think that's realistic. I'm not sure how this assumption got started. Perhaps it's because people only read the minimum requirements for farmland assessment plans and don't actually read written forest management plans that are written by competent foresters. Virtually everyone written, you know, by our firm, many other foresters have changed their standard recommendations in recent years to address things like exotic invasive species, even though they don't have to. So I'd like to ask you all to examine your own biases and see how they line up to reality. This is particularly true when those same Forest Service inspectors that were discussed during your conversation, they're also enforcing the ban on excessive and unnecessary cutting provisions that are written into the existing Farmland Assessment Act. And no, they aren't just catching up recently. Those Forest Service inspectors have been on a 3 or 4 year cycle for at least the last 9 or 10 years. And lastly, the last paragraph in that same section, and really there's an underlying theme to the forest resource management and sustainability part, especially in studying forest lands to develop sustainability criteria and indicators. Without mandatory management on preserved and publicly owned lands, data gathered would be incomplete and inaccurate, in my opinion. If farmers and forest landowners are going to be placed under a microscope, and if when I go into the woods, I have to worry about someone who likely lacks the education, experience, and training that I have, then let's have public and preserved forests analyzed as well. And let's see how preserved lands and private managed lands compare regarding forest health and sustainability. Specifically, let's see how poor health, unthinned forests that are slowly converting from oak-dominated to birch-maple forests, getting hammered by gypsum moths, and slowly being taken over by exotic plants, how that stacks up to tree farms. And, you know, in a way, I'm being a little facetious here, but I'd love to see a statistical representative survey between managed and unmanaged lands in New Jersey. I just think it's wrong to say, well, you're cutting trees, so you have to be doing something wrong. Well, no, it's really all about how. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just 2 points. One is, I seem to remember in part of our discussion about this that we did that last point that was made, and we were going to try to recommend that the state and the public lands managers adopt and look at those set up forestry practices. And I think that's a good idea, because I don't think that that some of the state forestry practices have been the best ones for a long time. But secondly, to the extent that the Forestry Association has examples as to how current farmland assessment framework has been used to advance those, then I think the staff and council would love to see those. Because if the possibilities are there, then absolutely it's much easier to chase the institution.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Okay, I can't comment on what took place here this morning because I wasn't here. Sorry, I couldn't have been here and heard what went on. But I asked a question last week. A date that had been changed from August 9th, 2004 to November 2005. I was wondering if you found the answer to that yet.
It was a question really of the evaluation of land. We used the closest Mod 4 data we had was November of 2000, was the 2005 date. Jeff will clarify that.
Sure, Mr. Rosa. You're referring to the date which was by which the Highlands Council had compiled all of the municipal zoning information.
This had to do with the
yes,
development credits.
Yes, and the allocation of development credits, right. and knowing what.
I was wondering why that was changed, and you know, if it actually was changed to that.
It was not necessarily changed. That was the time by which the council had then gathered all of the relevant zoning information for all 88 municipalities, so that's why that date is specified. With respect to what regulations state and otherwise get applied for purposes of looking at allocation, it's those rules and regulations by the state that were in place prior to August 17, 2004. That's the distinction. With respect to zoning, it does go to November of 2005 because that is the point by which the council staff had gathered all the relevant zoning information.
This effective valuation.
The dual appraisal valuation is as of August 9th, 2008.
That's
still correct.
But that issue that you were citing to relates only to this issue of allocation of credits.
Okay. I just have a couple real quick comments. Environmental extremists and crooked politicians brought us to some very bad places. would have had the Toss Island Dam had it not been knocked down by the environmentalists. And I was like watching NJN News last night. They said this year that the incidents of bears breaking into houses and things like that, and problems with bears, it was up 150%. Well, when you allow some things to happen like that because of the environment, you might use that as an excuse, but you have to realize that people have to live too. But another point is I thought about this last week when I was sitting here about how complicated this whole thing is. And then you hear, for example, everybody's familiar with how the cost of oil and everything, how it's going up like that. And then you hear them say, well, it's going to take 10 years if you drill or something like that to get the oil and stuff like that. That's such utter nonsense. The only reason it would take 10 years is because all the red tape that people have to go through, all the hoops they have to jump through. It's just another example. And I could go on and on. I won't bore you with it and take up your time, but you know, you really need to think about that. Thank you.
So I realize I didn't answer Mr. Shope's question before. It was about the memo he was referring to. Was a legal advice from our attorney to the council, which is confidential, and so we are not releasing that to the public. Any other comments? Okay. Any other council member comments? A motion to adjourn?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you all.
Thank you.